Smith.
I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut axes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to talk with Bill Scheer from the Campaign for America's Future about the big job summit and, you know, the economy, the budget, all of the stuff that we've been talking about for the past several weeks, the important stuff, not the divisive stuff, not the the abortion stuff like we're seeing in South Dakota and all of the stuff meant to divide us. Nope. How do we move this country forward? How do we pick up the pieces and go forward, given the fact that we've got governors all across the country who want to destroy working conditions, who want to destroy our voice on the job? How do we move forward? You look at right now in Congress. Congress right now has an 18% approval rating. 18%. Only 15% of independents approve of what Congress is doing, down from 23% in February. 20% of Democrats approve, down from 25%. And even the Republicans, who are the ones who were, hey, we won, yay! Even they're down. And you go, but this is what you wanted. 23%. 23% of Republicans. Now, understand, when these folks, these hardy 18% who approve, when they start to realize how bad they're getting screwed, and when all these cuts that Republicans keep throwing out there, I think that number will even fall. George Bush is looking at 18% and going, "Wow, you guys suck." Because the reality is, look, the Republican Party has caused a gridlock. Things have come to a screeching halt again. And they were the ones who were saying, well, we're gonna make things work. They can't even get a budget passed through the House. Understand, the Republican Party has always been, in my view, the party of the wealthy and big business. The party of special interest, the party of the lobbyists. Not the party of you and me. They are, for us, when I look at them, they're the party of no plans, no ideas, no vision. No vision of where we go to from here. We're in this mess that they've created by deregulating, by saying, you know what? We didn't learn the lessons from the Depression. We want to go back and give these big, powerful special interests as much power as we can possibly give them, because they will police themselves. We believe that wholeheartedly in our bizarre ideology, that we think that the big banks, who we gave the ability to gamble, that they weren't going to go too far. And what happened is they got addicted. They got addicted to the game. They got addicted to the big wins. They got addicted to the big money. And they went too far, like anything. It's like anything in life. None of this stuff is new. We've been down this path time and time again. Yet we never seem to quite learn the lesson that sometimes you need to restrain things. unfettered markets, laissez-faire doesn't work. Letting a kid loose in a candy store, not a good idea. But yet we seem to think that, banks and corporate America, they're going to be the ones who are above that. They're going to be the ones who are the adults in the room. They're going to be the ones who are able to say, you know what, we're better than that. We can restrain ourselves. It didn't happen. It didn't happen at all. And look at the mess that we're in. And again, it comes back down to this. We're in this massive hole that has been created by Wall Street. And I think, at least I hope everyone realizes that all of our problems stem from the fact that we gave Wall Street too much. We put too much in their hands. All of the problems we have, be it the foreclosure mess that's coming, and understand, there is, along with the tsunami that happened in Japan today, there is a tsunami of foreclosures coming because we basically held them off last year. And we're going to talk about that tonight because I think, you know, the way things are, and had we done what I said we should have done right from day one, when Bush was in office, I said the first thing, and if Bush wants to impress me, the first thing he should do with these mortgages is say, well, you know what? We in the federal government, we're going to buy them. And we're going to give everybody involved a haircut. You're going to pay, the homeowner's going to pay, the banks are going to take some deflation on the value of the house. We're going to make sure people can keep it, stay in their home, pay their mortgage, so that the entire housing economy doesn't collapse. But we didn't do that. We said, you know what? For the banks, we're going to bail them out. We're going to give them tons of money, the TARP, $750 billion in TARP funds. Here, take it. But for those people who understand, you know, the frame has been, and you got to love the frame, because the Republicans always do a very good job of framing things in the most simplistic of terms, with the blame always being those liberals who wanted to get involved. The way the story goes is those liberals, they made banks. They put guns to the banker's head and said, you give those people loans. And those people we do know as code for poor, black, minority. We understand that. Those people. So the story goes that through the CRA, the Community Reinvestment Act, those liberals gave those people loans. Those people who just wanted part of the American dream. They wanted to buy a house. So by doing this somehow, by putting a gun to the banker's head, we gave all these irresponsible people money, and now they're the ones who've drug us all down. Yet, you look down in Miami where million-dollar condo buildings with hundreds of million-dollar condos in them are empty because all those folks who bought those million-dollar condos are now broke, jobless. You look at these McMansion developments where these $400,000-$600,000 homes are empty and stripped of all of their wealth because the people who they were going after the American dream, they lost their jobs. And they were in over their head. So it was easy. You know, the frame was nice. It's those people. It's not those wealthy people. It's not those people who are reaching for the brass ring. No. It's those poor people who just wanted to make their lives better. Now look, the banking industry, they saw profit because there was no downside for them. There was nothing there. As soon as the mortgage, the person who wrote the mortgage wrote it, it was sold to the big banks, to Freddie and Fannie. It was bundled and it was sold off as an asset. And all the Saudi money coming into the country sucked it all up. And all the investors went crazy because, oh, this is prime A investment material here. Problem is, it was a bunch of junk. Problem is, when it all started to unwind, we realized that we had given the banks way too much power and that there was no responsibility. There was no accountability there. And as I said from the beginning, had we simply said we're going to take those over as a country, we'll be responsible for $750 billion, we're going to break up these big banks, we're going to make small community-sized regional banks instead of having these behemoths to where The guy writing the mortgage is the guy who's holding the mortgage. We didn't do that, though. We kept pushing it down the road. We kept pushing it down the road. We allowed lobbyists and the big banks and special interests to keep pushing this responsibility down the road, because they had done a whole bunch of very bizarre and what I would say illegal stuff. And now it's all coming home to roost. And all of these foreclosures are going to have to happen one way or another. So it will be interesting to see where we go from here. Before we move along, I want to just think about this thing, this tsunami, this earthquake that happened in Japan. My heart goes out to the folks there. It's a horrible tragedy. I know that, you know, as a country, we will do what we can best do to help them, be it with through funding, be it with aid, be it with our military. And I understand, as the president said today, that stuff is on the way. They are an ally of ours, and we, you know, as we would anyone, we reach out with our thoughts, our prayers, and our resources as well. Because, you know, something like that could happen to anyone. Could happen to us right now. You know, a story I was reading before, the coast of California was hit by high waves as a part of this, I understand. So our thoughts go with them. Anyway, again, today on the program, we're gonna take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. It's Friday, so we're gonna talk our future Friday. Also, we want to know what you think. All day today, we're going to be taking calls. Hopefully, this budget thing will be something on your mind. I'm curious how this is going to affect you, your family, your school districts. There's a big race in the 11th senatorial district on Tuesday. It'll be interesting to see how this works out there. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Bill Scheer from the Campaign for America's Future. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Open our doors!
Open our doors! Open our doors!
In a locked down capital so devoid of freedom and democracy that the people, reporters, and even some lawmakers were barred from entering, Republicans in Wisconsin destroyed public worker collective bargaining rights that workers here have had for 50 years. It was an ugly and brutish spectacle of what Democratic lawmakers here called political thuggery and junta rules. The state patrol, commanded by the father of the Republican brothers who lead Wisconsin's legislature, dragged protesters from the assembly entrance as Republicans pushed through the gutting of public worker collective bargaining on a 53-42 vote. Protesters gathered outside the Capitol in Madison were angry as they demanded to be let in Thursday. Tim Berkeley is vice president of AFSCME Local 60 in Madison.
We were up here at about 8 o'clock. What was really difficult was to watch the chief of police of Madison, Noble Ray, be denied entry four times until finally he got through to someone who allowed him in, and Jesse Jackson standing at the door being refused entry. It was horrendous.
Trying to walk through the press entrance with permission from Capitol Police to cover the story, I was strong-armed, shoved, and grabbed by the Wisconsin State Patrol.
What are you doing? What are you putting your hands on me for? Wait a minute. What is this? I'm a member of the press corps.
Which side are you on, boys?
Democrats and unions vowed legal challenges, and workers and their unions will continue their resistance, political and otherwise. Democratic senators are turning from exile in Illinois, and no one here defending collective bargaining is accepting this as final. It's been a long 4 weeks for labor leaders in Wisconsin, but after everything that went down during the past 2 days, workers showed Thursday that they still have the resolve to keep fighting. Jesse Russell reports.
However, the question that seemed to be on the minds of the thousands of public sector workers and supporters that gathered outside the Capitol building on Thursday evening was, what now? Wisconsin Education Association President Mary Bell was one of a number of speakers that tried to provide some guidance.
Recall Darling! Yeah! Recall Brooklyn!
Bell went on to say that Momentum had to continue to recall Walker in a year because he has abused the trust of working families throughout the state.
This governor has lied to you, he lied to me, he has lied to every child, every parent, and every resident in this state. He can never regain that trust.
No.
Why should we trust him again?
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, this past Thursday, the Campaign for America's Future had their job summit. Again, I guess the only people in the country talking about how we're going to create jobs and move the economy forward. Everybody else seems to want to talk about how we're going to steal rights from workers. That seems to be the key. Wisconsin, Ohio, Indiana, Idaho, Alabama, Utah, you name the state, and there, Michigan. There's an attempt to steal rights from workers, but nobody's talking about how we create those jobs. And here to talk to us about that jobs conference is Bill Scheer from the Campaign for America's Future. Ourfuture.org is the website. Bill, thanks for taking time for me.
Always a pleasure to talk to you.
You know, I look at this, and the only people I'm seeing right now are you guys talking about how we're going to create jobs and move this economy forward.
Well, it's bizarre because poll after poll shows that jobs are the number one issue with the American people. Everyone likes to campaign on the notion of jobs. You know, when John Boehner was running for speaker last year, his slogan was, "Where are the jobs?" But we haven't seen a single jobs bill come out of the Republican House. And all these conservative governors, most notably Scott Walker now, but they're either spending their time attacking public sector unions, or they're killing jobs projects like Chris Christie in New Jersey, killing a tunnel project, Rick Scott in Florida killing high-speed rail. No one is actually proposing jobs ideas, which is what everyone's asking for. So we put together a big summit on Thursday, bringing together some of the best minds on the subject to lay out all the different ways we could be creating jobs if we could actually get people to focus on it again.
And again, I don't think this is rocket science, and I'd like to hear some of the thoughts that came out, but for me, it's about building stuff. And you look at Scott Walker in Wisconsin and Kasich in Ohio, both, along with Walker in Florida, turned down the federal money to build a train. You know, it seems nuts to me. That's how you create jobs. That's how you create industry.
Well, that was the big focus with a lot of people. You had Mayor Antonio Villagrosa from Los Angeles. He has a plan to help finance infrastructure projects called the 3010 plan that would include an infrastructure bank to sort of to have a independent review of the best places to invest in infrastructure, you know, so it won't be all pork projects and earmarks. So it would go to the most important things. You had ideas for a new WPA, New Deal-style direct job creation, a real industrial policy, a civilian conservation corps. These are the kinds of ideas that should be on the table. And the infrastructure bank and high-speed rail are actually in the president's budget. He has a $53 billion high-speed rail plan and additional infrastructure bank proposal that the construction industry says would create 15 million jobs. But no one's talking about it because all the focus in Washington now is on the cuts and who can cut the most and cut the best. And so no one's talking about those jobs ideas.
Yeah, you know, I talked about in the opening segment that the Congress's approval rating, according to the one poll, is 18%. And you know, this close to the last election, you go eight. That's remarkable at how fast the Republicans have lost even their base, because evidently they didn't listen to the people who voted for them, who they claimed had this voice and it was jobs, jobs, jobs. Evidently they weren't listening.
Well, they took the wrong lesson from what happened after the election. You know, after the election we had this brief glimmer of both parties working together. And you can like and dislike what came out of that. There was the tax cut compromise, which had some good unemployment benefits. It had bad, you know, the estate tax cuts and the tax cuts for the wealthy being extended. They did that. They did Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal. They did the START treaty. They did food safety legislation, child nutrition legislation. And so coming out of all that, everyone's poll numbers went up. Everyone said, okay, you guys are finally getting it. You know, solve problems, work together, do your best. But then once the Republicans got sworn in January, they threw that all out the window and went straight into the most right-wing ideological posturing possible, and everyone's numbers are plummeting again.
Yeah, and it's nuts because nothing's going to get done. And this is what I predicted back in November. Once the Tea Party, you know, got their foot in the door and really the wrench in the gears here, as I think, we're not going to solve any problems for 2 years until the next election. And in that time, we're going to be more dependent on foreign energy, less capable of being independent, and thus have an economy that's not creating the jobs that we need and not meeting the needs of its people. And then we're talking about more cuts, more pain, more austerity, nothing good.
And this is one of the themes that came out of the conference, too, which is knowing that you're dealing with a Republican House that is not interested in solving problems. Don't get too bogged down in what is politically possible today. There's an immediate jobs crisis, but there's also a long-term problem with having a robust recovery. Let's put on the table what needs to be done. Put the short-term politics aside. Let the public know here are the planks that would mean robust job creation, and let the public decide which way they want to go and put the pressure on the Republicans to adhere to that. And if they don't get with the program, they can be voted out in 2012.
So number one, what was the best job creation idea out there? What's the plan?
Well, I think Leo Hinder is the one that put forth the idea of having a 21st century, WPA, Works Projects Administration. This is something that no political pundit is saying is feasible today. No one in Congress or few in Congress are seriously talking about it. But getting the idea out there, explaining it, showing how it worked to get us out of the Great Depression in the 30s, how it has applications today, show that it can resonate with the broader public, then you can change what's being talked about on the cable TV talk shows and in the editorial pages and the like. Those are the kinds of ideas that need to be pushed right now.
Yeah, you're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're Bill Scheer from the Campaign for America's Future. Ourfuture.org is the website. You know, right from the beginning, back when the economy collapsed when Bush was still in office, when the first extension came up, I said we shouldn't be extending unemployment. My thought was to take those extensions and hire people, make the government as employer of last resort, and begin doing all of the things that 2 years ago we needed to have done that still aren't done to this day. Any idea that something like that could be possible, you know, here moving forward? Because we've got folks who are the 99ers who are no longer eligible for unemployment. Where do they go?
I wish that was being seriously talked about right now. It isn't. I mean, the closest thing that's being talked about are the infrastructure planks in the president's budget, high-speed rail, mass transit, roads and bridges, clean energy investment, advanced manufacturing, and hiring 100,000 new teachers. Those are the biggest jobs ideas that have been put on the table. They would do at least 15 million jobs when you add it all up. And the Republican plan so far, their tally is zero. So if you ask me, that's where the contrast should be being made. And as far as we can expand the debate further to show, okay, we have these ideas that get you to 15 million. We have a lot more to do than that. We got 23 million people who are unemployed or underemployed. Let's build on those good ideas and take it farther and force the conservatives to pony up, ante up. What do you have that actually would create a single job?
Right. You know, here's the thing. You said the Republicans' job plan creates zero jobs. I wish it was only zero. What they're talking about doing, these massive, deep, drastic, draconian cuts that they keep putting out there, reports I've seen could cost us up to 700,000 jobs.
Well, if not up to a million, depending. I mean, the analysis runs from Ben Bernanke would say that their fiscal budget for this year would lose $200,000. Economic Policy Institute and Mark Zandi say 700,000 and Surf American Progress said 1 million. However way you cut it, it's a negative. No one is arguing. Nobody is arguing that it would create jobs. Even John Boehner himself raised the notion it would lose 200,000 jobs and said so be it. So there's not even a serious argument out there that they have a real jobs plan. All they have to lean on is, oh, if we cut spending and cut regulations, cut rules, businesses would magically grow. And, you know, you could argue that academically, I guess, but we did have an experience with a guy named George W. Bush where we did a lot of that, and there were not a lot of jobs created. So I would like to think they would learn from the lessons of the recent past and adjust their views.
You know, I use the analogy of every football play I ever drew up in my life, all the years I played football, every play that we ever drew up, either in the sand lot or either, you know, in organized football, every play was a touchdown. Didn't matter. Every play went all the way. It was a hundred yard run all the way, even if it was just to get an inch. This is the same idea with these kind of models that the Republicans, very, very hopeful, but have proven to be less than effective.
And it's what's bizarre about where their party's at. I mean, they know enough to know not to use George Bush's face on their bumper stickers. They know that he sees it as a failure and they should distance themselves from him. But they haven't explained to the public what they have learned from those failures and what they're going to do differently. And what's odd to me is that infrastructure used to be a bipartisan point of agreement. Even if you believed in mere limited government, infrastructure was a proper place for government. There was something that the private sector, they're not going to build an airport. It's not cost effective for an airline to build an entire airport for themselves, build a railroad track, build a road. That's just not going to happen. You put the public money in there, lay the foundation, and then private companies can come in and profit after that. So that's always been a point of agreement, but basically because Obama wants to do it, they're just taking the opposite side for the sake of doing it. It's not been their party's history, but it's what they're doing right now, and it's to the detriment of the country.
Well, I think the only people against that are the Republicans in Congress right now. I don't know if you saw it. I'm sure you did. The Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO came together on a – I don't think that's ever happened in the past where those two groups have come together on a joint statement and agreed that, you know what? We do need to be building infrastructure, rail, highways, bridges, all of that stuff for not only jobs but for also the future of this economy.
And the Republicans at the state level, not so many of these conservative governors – but, you know, in Florida, when Rick Scott killed the high-speed rail project, there are several Republicans in the state legislature livid with him because they had already voted to bring it there. One of them even sued the governor, saying you broke the law and the Constitution by overruling the will of the legislature. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court overruled. But it does show that there are Republicans in existence that understand that infrastructure creates jobs and is a proper role of government. They're just not active on the national level or in the governor's mansions these days.
Yeah, let me ask you this, Bill Scheer. You know, all I keep hearing every time I turn on C-SPAN, I see Erskine Bowles and his curmudgeon sidekick, Alan Simpson. There just seems to be this obsession with cutting things for working people. There just seems to be this blind obsession on austerity, if you will, taking from the working class, making us tighten our belts, but not really asking those who, you know, are fat and happy to pitch in. What's with that?
Well, you know, Simpson has proven to be, I think, a boon for those of us who are trying to debunk the notion that austerity now is a wise fiscal policy, because he's been such a buffoon over the past few months, continually putting his foot in his mouth, making terrible arguments for his position, insulting pretty much every age group in the country at this point. And so when they came forth with their deficit reduction plan in December, many of us were concerned that it would get this huge media push, be treated as this golden bipartisan plan, and that the president would be swept up into it. But they got beat down so hard, the polling on it was awful, and the president has not embraced it to this date. That doesn't mean that we're out of the woods,
right?
But we were worried that he was going to embrace it in the State of the Union address, and he did not. I think it's partly because of the work that many of us did to show how flawed it was, and Simpson just keeps making his own position worse. So they're not getting their way as far as their actual planks are concerned, but they are still keeping the conversation on austerity, which is hurting our ability to do something opposite and actually investing in job creation.
Yeah, I don't know if the best messaging is to call the largest voting bloc in the country a bunch of greedy geezers.
Well, he's going after the greedy users for a while. Then last week he went after the youth, and that's everyone's favorite talking point. It's for our children. We need to slash everybody's pensions for our children. And then he goes off and insults the children for the music that they listen to and the clothes that they wear. So hopefully that shows how serious that talking point is. You know, things that are good for our kids are jobs, clean environment, safe food, healthcare. Those are things that our children and grandchildren are going to need, and all these cuts are not going to bring it to them.
So let me ask you this, you know, because I'm looking at the Republicans' position, and I got about 2 minutes left here. I'm looking at the Republican position right now, and the elections are still far down the road. But you look at what's gone on, 18% in Congress right now, that's the approval rating. You look at Walker's disapproval rating of almost 60%. You look at the attacks on working people. You finally got, I think you've awakened a working class that's looking at the Republican Party with a jaundiced eye. Can the Republicans bounce back from this, do you think?
Well, you know, Walker's mishandling of the pension situation there has been a huge help. I mean, the fear was that if he broke the Wisconsin Union, that every conservative governor was going to follow suit. And not that people aren't still going to try, but, you know, Walker won by cheating, by breaking the rules about quorums and open meeting laws, and he hurt his poll numbers in the process. So he's not winning with a sense of momentum. So that's good for us.
Yep.
You do have to worry about what the economy is going to look like in 2012. And if the economy does not keep going on upward trajectory, if it's still stagnant or falling back, that's going to give Republicans and conservatives the ability to say, none of this worked, the government spending didn't work, stimulus didn't work, healthcare reform didn't work, fairly or unfairly. So that would give them an opening that would be hard for us to deal with. That's why we've made the point so strongly that you have to show you have additional ideas about job creation. So regardless of what happens with the economy, you're showing that you want to keep putting us on a better path and you're not just stuck with the status quo.
Yeah, all righty. Bill Scheer, Campaign for America's Future. Ourfuture.org is the website. Appreciate your time, brother.
Always a pleasure.
Keep up the good work.
Take care.
We're going to take a quick break right back after this with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Not right wing. John Rice. The Rick Smith Show.
Occasionally, we Texans have a responsibility to explain our Texanity to befuddled out-of-staters. For example, you might have heard about Governor Rick Perry. Known for his chronic temper tantrums over big bad government's coercive intrusiveness into people's private affairs. So, how can we explain the fact that his top legislative priority this year is not to cope with the $27 billion budget deficit he's run up, but to require that all Texas women facing the gut-wrenching decision of whether to have an abortion must first undergo a state-mandated sonogram? Yes, Mr. Small Government wants to compel Texas doctors to show an ultrasound image of the fetus to these women, then force them to listen to the fetal heartbeat and sit still for a lecture on fetal development. As a female state senator dryly noted, Perry is going to shrink government until it fits into a woman's uterus. Gubernatorial hypocrisy? Not at all, insists Perry, who points out that women can avoid his version of big government intrusion simply by choosing not to get pregnant. And you'll be glad to know that he's been super helpful in preventing unwanted pregnancies by making Texas the nation's number one provider of abstinence-only sex education. Unfortunately, this abstinence-only doctrine has resulted in Texas also having the nation's third highest teen pregnancy rate. But Perry is undeterred by inconvenient facts. Abstinence works, he recently told an interviewer. But, he was asked, what about all those teen pregnancies? It works, he reiterated. How does he know? From my own personal life, he explained. This is Jim Hightower saying, sure enough, his wife has not been noticeably pregnant in more than a couple of decades, so maybe he has been abstaining from sex. That could explain his chronic insanity, or, as we call it down here, Texanity.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small.
by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all.
If it's class warfare, my class is winning, but they shouldn't be.
A working class hero is something to be.
The taxation system has tilted toward the rich and away from the middle class.
A working class hero is something to be.
You know, while the Republicans and Democrats fight over to the degree of how badly we're going to get the shaft, our working class hero, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, introduced a bill yesterday that would establish a surcharge, a surtax on the millionaires and the billionaires. And it would strip deductions for oil companies, a whole bunch of these bizarre tax deductions that we give oil companies. He says he believes it will cut the deficit by about $50 billion. For me, again, it comes back down to this. Look, if I'm going to have to sacrifice, if I'm going to have to ask the family next door to me who's struggling to make ends meet to sacrifice even further, if we're going to have to ask a family who's maybe has an autistic child or a special needs kid that, you know, those school programs aren't going to be there, if we're going to have to do that, the least we can do is, you know, go after some people who are doing all right. Bernie calls his bill the Emergency Deficit Reduction Act. And the Emergency Deficit Reduction Act would raise taxes by just 5.4% on any income over $1 million. I don't know many people in our listening area who make over $1 million a year. Anyway, the reality is this is something I've been advocating for quite some time. The reality in this is go back to a reasonable tax code when, oh, I don't know, a good socialist was in office like Eisenhower. Back in February, you'll remember a Wall Street Journal NBC poll said 81% of those surveyed said a surcharge, one of these surtaxes on millionaires and billionaires would be an acceptable way to close the budget. And now you got Republicans, you know, who love to say that the American people have spoken and that these radically deep, drastic, draconian cuts they're trying to jam through are what the American people told them they wanted. Evidently, the American people told them they wanted massive education cuts and wanted massive cuts to mental health programs. I don't remember that, but you know, maybe in their cloakroom, that's what they heard. 81%. And when 81% say raise taxes on the top bracket and our Congress does nothing, and the only bill out there is by our guy Bernie Sanders, you know something's about. Republicans, Sanders fumes, want to balance a budget solely on the backs of the middle class and some of the most vulnerable people in this country. He also said Democrats aren't serious about deficits if they ignore revenue. And I absolutely agree. You know, it's something that has to be looked at on both sides of the equation. Let's go to the phone lines. We've got Jim on line one. How are we doing tonight, Jim?
Pretty, not too well.
What's going on?
Well, I think you probably know what's going on if you look at television today.
The tsunami in Japan?
Well, not only that, but the way that governor of Wisconsin has circumvented the law.
Well, then, yeah. That's been the last couple of days. And look, we've been waiting for this. It's now happened. Now what do we do? How do we react?
The only thing they can do is vote his ass out of office.
And that they're working on recalling
and
the
referendum initiative, referendum and recall.
Well, he's not going to be able to be recalled until early next year.
He has to be in office over a year for that.
Right, but they are working on a recall on eight of the other the senators who are eligible, and a couple of them, there's a good chance they're gone. The reports that we're getting back from Wisconsin is they're well on their way to getting enough signatures to get these people on the ballot and get them recalled.
I would hope so.
But it's a matter of standing together and a matter of fighting back. And you know what? If you got a couple extra bucks, send them a couple of bucks to help get that recall effort moving and to keep it moving. That's what we should be doing.
Well, absolutely.
All right. I appreciate the call, Jim. Thank you so much, brother. And looking at this budget thing, we do have some options. And you got to ask the question, what are the choices? What choices do we have? Republicans want to cut early childhood education programs. They want to cut $11 billion in early childhood education programs. What could we be doing? We could save that $11 billion for those kids, and we could, maybe look at the per year cost of recent tax cuts for the millionaires with the estate tax, $11.5 billion. They're talking about cutting funding to low-income housing programs. Maybe we could take a look at the cost of the mortgage interest that we allow the very wealthy to deduct off of their vacation homes. You know, just a thought. You know, they want to cut low-income housing $8.9 billion, yet we're giving $8.9 billion away over 10 years to tax deductions for people for their vacation home. I don't have a problem with people taking the deduction for their primary home. In fact, that's what we want. We want more people to have homes. But I shouldn't be paying for someone's second, third, fourth, or in John McCain's case, seventh. Just shouldn't happen. Republicans want to cut nutrition programs for the poor. They want to cut WIC. $7.6 billion they say it's going to cost. I say maybe we should look at the cost of estate planning techniques used by the wealthy to avoid paying their estate taxes. Right about the same amount of money. Why are we looking at one and not the other? And we'll go right down the list. They want to cut $4.6 billion in teacher training and after-school programs. Yet nobody's talking about the $5.2 billion cost of removing the itemized deductions for high-income taxpayers. You know, some of the big tax breaks these wealthy folks get. We're not talking about that. They want to eliminate $4.1 billion in job training for unemployed folks. Yet, we're not talking about the $4.1 billion it costs us to allow corporations to leave the U.S. and all the tax breaks they take from doing that. Not talking about that. The Republicans want to cut $2.5 billion from LIHEAP, the low income home energy assistance program. Want to cut that $2.5 billion, and they don't even have a thought of that. Doesn't bother them at all that Granny could be freezing to death in her home. But those $2.5 billion tax breaks for the oil companies, oh yeah, we got to keep those. The $2.5 billion that Obama wanted to put forth for community health centers, Republicans want to slash that. But the nearly $5 billion that it costs to extend alcohol fuel tax breaks, we need to keep those. So as you're seeing, a lot of pain for human people, not so much for corporate people. Human people suffer, sacrifice, tighten their belts. Corporate people, well, they benefit. And I wouldn't mind if they got nothing. But as you just pointed out, they're getting tens of billions of dollars at a time when we're asking human people. Because evidently now corporations are people. So we have to differentiate between the people, human people, corporate people. The human people, you've got to suck it up. Tighten the belt. Corporate people, yeah, you're all right. And the thing is I haven't seen a single Republican propose asking anything of corporations. Nothing. Maybe Congress should start looking at reining in some of the big tax breaks that we give to companies who move our jobs overseas instead of the cuts to job training. Maybe we should be going after these big oil companies. Maybe we should be going after some of these biofuel companies who are getting these massive tax breaks. And look, I understand tax breaks are important sometimes. I get it. We want to encourage certain behavior and discourage other. I want to encourage people to feed their children. So the WIC program, Women's Infants and Children, I think that's a good program. I'm not so thrilled when corporate America moves jobs from here in Pennsylvania to China or India or who knows where. Not so thrilled with that. So I don't want to make that an incentive. If they do it, I think they should be punished for it, not rewarded by us giving them more money. So there are certain tax breaks that I'm in favor of. Tax breaks for alternative energy, right there. Tax breaks for more oil companies, no, not really. The research and development tax credit. I'm in favor of that. Renewable energy tax credits, in favor of that. Earned income tax credits for poor working people, in favor of that. I'm in favor of using the tax code, like I said, to encourage certain behavior, but also, you know, like the carrot and the stick, to discourage behavior. You create jobs here, we're going to help you out. You take jobs away, sorry, not going to happen. Doesn't that make sense? Yet the only discussion I keep hearing, and maybe you're hearing something different, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425, is we need to cut things for those workers. Alan Simpson keeps talking about, well, we need to rein in those entitlements so old people can't have health care and old people don't get the Social Security that they were promised. I'm sorry, no, it's not these old people. It's those old people in the future. See, because that's what they're doing. They're creating that divide. Oh, you folks who have it now, you're okay. We're just going to go after those people in the future. Make it work like it used to. You know, you could collect it 7 years after your death. That's it, man. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
Changing America for the better.
Our workers' comp system is a confusing maze of rules, delays, and loopholes, where workers struggle to collect what they are owed. Bills don't get paid, and families struggle to put food on the table after a serious work injury. What happens when you're injured on the job in Pennsylvania? Most people think you just apply for workers' comp, and you'll get paid for lost time, and your medical bills will be covered. Sadly, in Pennsylvania, that is not the case. The good news is, it doesn't have to be that way. Hi, I'm Ron Calhoun, and I'm a Central Pennsylvania workers' compensation attorney. It's my job to make sure injured workers receive the benefits they deserve. In the last 20 years, I have helped hundreds of Pennsylvania workers and their families after they've suffered from a work injury. If you've been injured on the job, I'd like the chance to show you how I might be able to do the same for you. Why not find out what you're rightfully owed? Call me at 717-695-4722. You have nothing to lose and much to gain. Call me at 695-4722.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Also, check out their website at therickSmithShow.com. If you want to contact me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. If your phone doesn't work, you can email me. I do answer all emails personally. I saw this story in the Reading Eagle today. The headline reads, at GOP dinner, Medaglia says he applauds budget's education cuts. Larry Medaglia, this is a guy who's running, a guy named Michael Opaque passed away. He was the senator for the 11th senatorial district here in Pennsylvania. And it covers Berks and most of eastern, covers Reading and most of eastern Berks County, here in the center of the state. Since he passed, this Larry Medaglia and Judy Schwank, the Democrat, are running to replace him, and it'll be on the coming Tuesday is the election. So he's at this dinner, to raise some money, and he stands up and says, I support the education cuts, and says, in fact, he said, I welcome it, and I believe you do too. I applaud it, I welcome it, and I believe you do too, he said. And I look at this and I go, there's some things here that kind of make me wonder. He's trying to compare himself to George W. Bush. He said, George W.'s nickname was 43. I'd like mine to be 31. because there are 30 Republicans in our Senate here. He would be the 31st. This is going to be an interesting election day because it's going to really be a barometer, I think, of how people feel about Corbett's budget. The priorities laid out before the voters, this is an opportunity for, I think, them to have that moment where they either say, we're going to swallow the bitter pill, or we're going to stand up and fight back. Because, if you remember, the good governor, proposed that, Berks County, where this guy is, will get a $33 million cut to their schools. And evidently, according to Medaglia, he applauds it and welcomes it. Corbett's gutting the opportunity of working class kids to go on to college by cutting more than 50% of the higher education funding. Evidently, Republican Larry Medaglia applauds it and welcomes it. Corbett wants to fire more than 1,500 workers here at a time when the Republican Party, again, said that they were going to create jobs, and yet you've got this guy, Larry Medaglia, who says he applauds it and welcomes it. Tom Corbett handed out hundreds of millions of dollars in corporate tax breaks, hundreds of millions of dollars to special interests, and evidently Medaglia, who, running for that seat, applauds it and welcomes it. Now, because of all this, Corbett's going to cause those folks, local property taxes, to go through the roof. And evidently, according to Medaglia, he applauds it and welcomes it. And the weird thing is he thinks that the people of that district believe it too. And the reality is there are a lot of options here, especially here in Pennsylvania, that the Republicans, people like Medaglia, would never consider. Because they're basically a bunch of yes men who walk in lockstep with the party, afraid that they're not going to get the corporate cash, afraid that they're not going to get money from these kind of dinners who throw them, $1,000 a plate. Even if it's the most reasonable, even if it's right, even if it's conservative, they're not going to pass it through. They're not even going to consider it because the corporateers, the profiteers, aren't going to let it. And you look at the massive cuts that were in that budget. Mr. Medaglia, he's all in favor of it. All in favor. Applauds it. Welcomes it. What we should be doing, and what people like Medaglia would never consider, is looking at fairness and closing some of the corporate loopholes that are out there. Some of those tax loopholes, like the one where you can open up a P.O. box in Delaware and funnel all your profits through. And you go, well, Rick, why is that fairness? What does that have to do with fairness? Well, when 30% of the companies in the state are paying the corporate tax rate and 70% of the big companies leave and open up a P.O. box to funnel their profits through, don't you think there's an issue of fairness there? I do. If you were to close that Delaware loophole, you could raise about $450 million a year. That is a huge, huge amount of money. You want to talk about responsibility? Why aren't we taxing the drillers in this state? We are sitting on a gold mine. We're the only state in the country. The only state that doesn't levy even the most reasonable fracking tax. Even though we know it's going to destroy the environment, even though we know it's going to cause water problems and land problems and road problems, giving up more than $400 million a year. Now, between those, just those two things, you're talking about $850 million. Almost as much as he's cutting in education, but they won't cut, they won't consider that. Now let's talk about something that would be timely, because the days that this thing was important, long past. And the sales tax giveaway, and the giveaway to the Walmarts and the big corporations who get this savings of 1% on their taxes by just paying it on time. I mean, I'm sorry. I don't get a tax break for paying my taxes on time. Sorry, it doesn't happen. They say that would save in the neighborhood of $76 million. You want to talk about accountability? Why are we one of the only states in the country that don't tax smokeless tobacco or cigars? Something that could raise the state $50 million. So now we're up to almost $1 billion. And there's some other, you know, just some little things we could be doing. Like, oh, I don't know, maybe get rid of that online sales tax exemption that costs the state about $62 million. Most of the other states in the country are doing it. You want to talk about equitable? Maybe we should be looking at our tax system. Maybe we should be increasing the non-wage tax income, the non-wage income. You know, the people who make their living, you know, collecting dividend checks, selling stock. Maybe look at them. Just raise it just a little bit, maybe 4%. Could raise us about $350 million a year. But we're not going to consider those things. Why? Because that could hurt the corporate person. And why should we hurt the corporate person when we're really sticking it to the human person? Right now in the state of Pennsylvania, and this is shocking to me, right now in this state, because of how we tax things and how we've allowed the very wealthy and their Republican lackeys to set things up. The reality in this state is that the poorest 20%, those people at the very bottom, that bottom fifth of the population here in the state of Pennsylvania, they pay 11.2% of the tax burden. 11.2. Do you know what the top 1% pays? Our upper crust. 3.9%. Explain to me the fairness. Explain to me the equity, the responsibility. Explain to me all of this stuff, because I'm not getting it. How we can look to the people who don't have and say, you know what? We want more from you. It's not bad enough that we're taking your wage. It's not bad enough that we're not going to produce the services that you need to make your life better. No, no. We need to give more away. We need to help enrich the very wealthy. I'm curious your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Because, you know, look, at the end of this, the reality is, if you don't stand up now and fight back, they're going to take every penny. We're right back after this.
Controversial, thought-provoking, opinionated. Rick Smith.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Open our doors! Open our doors!
In a locked-down capital so devoid of freedom and democracy that the people, reporters, and even some lawmakers were barred from entering, Republicans in Wisconsin destroyed public worker collective bargaining rights that workers here have had for 50 years. It was an ugly and brutish spectacle of what Democratic lawmakers here called political thuggery and junta rules. The state patrol, commanded by the father of the Republican brothers who lead Wisconsin's legislature, dragged protesters from the assembly entrance as Republicans pushed through the gutting of public worker collective bargaining on a 53-42 vote. Protesters gathered outside the Capitol in Madison were angry as they demanded to be let in Thursday. Tim Berkeley is vice president of AFSCME Local 60 in Madison.
We were up here at about 8 o'clock. It was really difficult was to watch the chief of police of Madison, Noble Ray, be denied entry four times until finally he got through to someone to allow him in. And Jesse Jackson standing at the door being refused entry, it was horrendous.
Trying to walk through the press entrance with permission from Capitol Police to cover the story, I was strong-armed, shoved, and grabbed by the Wisconsin State Patrol.
What are you doing? What are you putting your hands on me for? Wait a minute. What is this? I'm a member of the press corps.
Which side are you on, boys?
Democrats and unions vowed legal challenges, and workers and their unions will continue their resistance, political and otherwise.
People united will never be defeated.
Democratic senators are returning from exile in Illinois, and no one here defending collective bargaining is accepting this as final. It's been a long 4 weeks for labor leaders in Wisconsin, but after everything that went down during the past 2 days, workers showed Thursday that they still have the resolve to keep fighting. Jesse Russell reports.
However, the question has seemed to be on the minds of the thousands of public sector workers and supporters that gathered outside the Capitol building on Thursday evening was, what now? Wisconsin Education Association President Mary Bell was one of a number of speakers that tried to provide some guidance. Bell went on to say that Momentum had to continue to recall Walker in a year because he has abused the trust of working families throughout the state.
This governor has lied to you. He has lied to me. He has lied to every child, every parent, and every resident in this state. He can never regain that trust.
No.
Why should we trust him again?
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, you can email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Ray LaHood, Transportation Secretary, on Friday said he was officially making the $2.4 billion that Rick Scott in Florida turned down, the high-speed rail money rejected by Florida, available to other states. And I'm saying, hey, Tom, I know you got a problem with raising taxes. Why don't you go ask for that money to build that rail, create some jobs here, kind of buck the trend of Wisconsin and Ohio and Florida, and maybe care about your state. That would be a nice start, wouldn't it? The transportation secretary has said he would have no trouble finding another state to take the money. And he said today that new applicants for the funds would be collected until April 4th, according to Reuters. Look, at the end of this, there's a bunch of states, California being one of them, who would love to have the money to go ahead and continue building their 800-mile railway that's going to connect San Francisco to Los Angeles. And, you know, it's something we should have done years ago, but at least they're doing it. Bill Nelson, Democrat from Florida, senator there, he criticized Scott for rejecting the funds, but, you know, said LaHood's doing the right thing. And according to Nelson, he thinks that Florida is going to have the ability on the local level, and this might be interesting to watch, that one of the local transit authorities, along with Amtrak, might be able to get this money and build this stuff, still a public entity, but aside from the governor. And that'd be kind of interesting to see, because at some point, you know, the people of the state have got to be going, hey, stupid, what are you doing? We'd like to have that. I don't know if you've driven through Florida. There's not a lot of public transportation. And their highways, very crowded. I got an email today that I thought I wanted to share a little bit of it with you, or just a basic overview. And he was talking about education and these massive cuts. And he was talking about himself, saying, you know, when I was in college back in the 70s, Penn State was going through some financial troubles. And he said, you know, I wanted to go to a good engineering school, and, you know, Penn State was having some trouble. And ultimately he said he decided to go to Maryland, to the University of Maryland, to their engineering school, who right now, according to many rankings, is one of the tops in the country, and even the Chinese have ranked it in the top 15 in the world. But he's saying, look, you know, during this time, as a student, I had to make that choice. Do I stay in Pennsylvania? Because he says his father was a professor at Penn State in Altoona. And he says, look, you know, I had to make that choice. Was I going to go to Penn State and hope that the education would be recognized as one of the better schools, or do I go somewhere else? And he ended up going somewhere else. And what I find interesting is this is one of the guys who's done some amazing stuff. He's a senior principal engineer for some big company, and he's, you know, done mission ops on the Glory satellite. You know, I guess it's one that's just been lost. But he's done a whole bunch of other really cool stuff. And this is a guy who, you know, what happens if he goes to Penn State and the department is underfunded? You know, what happens? You know, what happens to our education system if we don't fully fund it? Do we close a university? Do we lose those kids to somewhere else? You know, this idea that we can cut education funding and it's not going to have any ramifications, it's not going to cause us any trouble, is ludicrous. The idea, and you know, this has been sold to us. You know, understand, we've been sold this bill of goods time and time again, which is we don't need those dirty industries. We don't need to manufacture anything. We don't need to build things. We simply need to have a knowledge-based economy of people wearing white shirts and shuffling papers around. And then they told us, oh, we need the computer economy because we need the knowledge-based people to be able to. And every time you turn around, they're taking that away. And now they're making it harder to even get to a point where maybe you could compete for those jobs. And part of me goes, you know, the wealth class is looking around and going, there's nothing left for us. You know, we've shipped so many jobs overseas that everybody's looking for our jobs now. So what we need to do is we need to drop that floor. We need to make things less available. And that to me is very, very troublesome. Also troublesome. According to Reuters, a federal judge in Kansas today ruled against a group of suburban parents who sought to put a property tax increase on the ballot in order to raise funds for their public school. Now, look, you know, Governor Brownback, or Brownback Mountain, whatever you want to call him, he took these folks to court. Said, nope, we're not going to allow anyone to raise their property taxes for their school above the cap. Because, like Pennsylvania, they have capped how much it can increase, which is going to be an interesting scenario here. Now that the governor's cutting $1 billion from education, will the local municipalities be able to deal with that? Because there's only so much they can raise their taxes. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, how this ruling could affect us here and affect people across the country, really, because this is an example of people who are saying voluntarily, we want to raise our taxes. Please take our tax money, put it into schools because we believe in schools. Now, the people who filed the suit, they live in the Shawnee Mission School District, which has been called one of the upper crust, if you will. They're one of the better school districts, very wealthy area. Typically, a home in that district, $250,000 and up. Now, what they want to do is they want to levy simply a $260 a year tax on a home of $250,000, which is a lot of money. But when you're when you're living in that kind of area and you believe in education, you know, it is what it is. What's going to happen now that they can't, now that the courts have stepped in and said, sorry, the tax scheme that your state has implemented, and it's interesting the decision he came down with. He came down with a decision saying that the grounds of the case were basically that the cap was a crucial and integral part of the state's complex formula for distributing education funds in a manner meant to ensure that wealthy school districts don't pull far ahead of poorer school districts. He says, quote, if the plaintiffs were to prevail on their claim that the cap is unconstitutional, the entire school funding scheme would then be struck down. And, you know, the lawyer for the group says, you know, it's amazing that in a nation founded on freedom and local initiative, he says it's inconceivable that any state would prohibit a community from voluntarily raising taxes to improve their kids' education. And I kind of agree, but this is one of those scenarios where, you know, again, education is that great equalizer. It's that great equalizer that's going to give you opportunity to move forward. Should we be having school districts like Shawnee Mission who can afford to raise their taxes to, you know, like some in this area, some in the Philadelphia area, $20,000 a student, while others are in the $6,000-$7,000 range? Should you have an unequal society like that? And it's interesting. I would say the fair part of this would be, fine, you can raise your taxes, but it's all going to go into a pool and it's all going to be divvied up. You know, if we had a one-pot system and the wealthy wanted to contribute and they wanted their schools to be better, then we would have everybody's schools better. See, that's where my mindset is. This idea that we can slash and burn education and still be a 21st century economy and still be a world power is just not going to happen. We are going to lose more knowledge-based jobs. In fact, every once in a while, at least once a week, I see a story where a research and development company is moving to China. Now, the computer people have been moving for months because that's where the resources are. That's where the education money is being allocated. And you look at what we're doing. We're constricting. We're going the other way. No more research and development money for the universities. No more money for students. No more money for innovation. And that used to be the hallmark of this country. I had a friend of mine was telling me about a university in Israel, and the name of the university slips my mind. But he was saying, you know, it's a very small university, but within a couple blocks, you've got every major computer company who has set up shop and has done research and development around this university because they so believe in education and they so heavily fund education that those companies say that's where we have to be. We have to be near that school. It's like MIT. There are companies that are around that school that say, you know, we need to be near this knowledge base, this cutting-edge technology, because that's where this stuff happens. Universities are laboratories for this stuff. And we used to believe in that, but now we got a governor who's saying, you know what? 54% of the funding, gone. What's that going to mean for jobs? We had the president of APSCUF on here the other night, said they're talking about closing one of the universities, one of the 14 owned state universities. Is that the right direction? When you're talking about your economy, the only way you're going to succeed in this country is to be part of the knowledge-based economy? And is that what you want for your children? I mean, I want for my kids as much opportunity as their intellect, their talents, their work ethic take them. I don't want their future based on how much can we save the wealth class. And how many tax breaks can we give corporations who take their wealth out of the state? Amazing stuff. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
RFK and the USA. RFK and the USA. Deeply blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Occasionally, we Texans have a responsibility to explain our Texanity to befuddled out-of-staters. For example, you might have heard about Governor Rick Perry, known for his chronic temper tantrums over big bad government's coercive intrusiveness into people's private affairs. So, how can we explain the fact that his top legislative priority this year is not to cope with the $27 billion budget deficit he's run up, but to require that all Texas women facing the gut-wrenching decision of whether to have an abortion must first undergo a state-mandated sonogram? Yes, Mr. Small Government wants to compel Texas doctors to show an ultrasound image of the fetus to these women, then force them to listen to the fetal heartbeat and sit still for a lecture on fetal development. As a female state senator dryly noted, Perry is going to shrink government until it fits into a woman's uterus. Gubernatorial hypocrisy? Not at all, insists Perry, who points out that women can avoid his version of big government intrusion simply by choosing not to get pregnant. And you will be glad to know that he's been super helpful in preventing unwanted pregnancies by making Texas the nation's number one provider of abstinence-only sex education. Unfortunately, this abstinence-only doctrine has resulted in Texas also having the nation's third highest teen pregnancy rate. But Perry is undeterred by inconvenient facts. Abstinence works, he recently told an interviewer. But, he was asked, what about all those teen pregnancies? It works, he reiterated. How does he know? From my own personal life, he explained. This is Jim Hightower saying, sure enough, his wife has not been noticeably pregnant in more than a couple of decades, so maybe he has been abstaining from sex. That could explain his chronic insanity, or, as we call it down here, Texanity.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.com.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
What the hell are we fighting for? Just surrender and water down. Just got time to say your prayer. While you're waiting for a hammer,
Well, the Wall Street Journal reported today that Google granted almost $9 million in bonuses and $50 million in equity to four senior executives last year. But the web giant's co-founders and its chief executive didn't receive any annual compensation. That's kind of interesting. In its regulatory filings today, with the Securities and Exchange Commission, Google said Chief Financial Officer Patrick Pinochet received $2.7 million in bonus and equity valued at $15 million under the company's executive bonus plan. Chief Business Officer Nikesh Arora received $2.7 million and an equity grant of $20 million, while Alan Eukestis, he got $1.8 million and $10 million in equity value, and Jonathan Rosenberg, Senior Vice President, took $1.7 million bonus and $5 million in equity value. Again, you know, a lot of money there, and we're talking about cutting schools. Google saw their profits jump more than 30% last year to $8.5 billion, as revenue jumped as well. Interesting numbers that, you know, hey, they're doing very well. So I say, you know what, instead of cutting school programs, maybe we should just ask them for a loan. What do you think? Some interesting things, though. This idea, I don't know if you've been paying attention to what's going on in Wisconsin, and we talked about this the other night. This M&I Bank, yesterday there was a run on M&I Bank of people, you know, rushing to take their firemen and policemen and teachers and all these folks rushing to get their money out of the bank. In fact, one guy, the report is, took as much as $192,000 out. Amazing. And moved it somewhere else. We called yesterday to find out, hey, are you still open? And turns out, bank was closed. And good. The right wing has gone nuts over this. The right wing has their panties all up in a bunch because, you know, the union thugs are bullying this poor bank. You know, this poor bank that, you know, reports I've seen said that they took about $1.7 billion of Bush's TARP welfare. So by taking money, and help me if I'm missing this here. The right is saying that by taking money out of a bank that you don't agree with their policies and moving it to a place where you're not funding your own demise, somehow that's bullying. Somehow you're a union thug. I'm not getting that. I give these guys credit for being smart enough to wake up and realize that the very people that they're doing business with are screwing them. So, to help slow the damage, M&I Bank closed its doors, like I said, to help, you know, pretty much to keep people from getting their money. And you don't hear Rand Paul whining about that. The other day, all he talked about is he can't find a toilet that flushes or a light bulb that's bright enough for him because he's a consumer and he should be able to do whatever he wants. You don't hear him coming to the defense of the consumers at these banks who've decided that this bank isn't in their interest. You don't hear that, do you? M&I put out a press release at like 6:30 tonight. They're trying to calm things down, or at least maybe tell their employees that they're doing something. I don't know. Here's what they wrote. M&I has not taken and will not take a position either for or against the budget repair bill. As M&I has publicly stated before, M&I has not contributed to any candidate or did not contribute to Governor Walker or Mayor Barrett in the last gubernatorial election. They went on to say M&I has over 6,000 employees in Wisconsin, and in the great tradition of political freedom in this country, those employees have the right to contribute to the candidate of their choice. Also, M&I employees contributed to both Wisconsin gubernatorial candidates in the last election. So they go on to finish off with the pandering to the teachers and saying, oh, please come back. M&I is proud of our tradition of standing with teachers, nurses, police officers, firefighters, and other dedicated public employees to support, improve, and grow Wisconsin communities. The only problem with that is it seems mighty fishy and a bit too coordinated that on the day the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported that Scott Walker was proposing massive cuts for state workers to address the deficit, M&I bank executives donated $12,725 on the very day. Seems a bit fishy to me. Seems a bit coordinated. Was it Walker has shown that he's willing to take a phone call from a rich guy to get a couple of bucks to run some ads. Was it a phone call that was taken that says, okay, M&I Bank, I hear you. We're going to go after these state workers. We're going to go after this. We're going to give you what you want. Because there were, I think there were like 25 people who donated on that very day. It's amazing. But again, very coordinated and kind of fishy. And what's interesting to me is how this thing in Wisconsin has affected people. And a Wall Street Journal article today that I came across made me look at some weird scenarios. And I've often wondered how husband and wife who are completely different political ideologies can stay together. I don't get it. I can't imagine, but I look at this couple that they talked about, this Shafidi family. She's a school teacher. He is a manager of a media rating company. The school teacher, she thinks that, the folks who, the Democrats who left the state and went to Illinois, she calls them heroes, especially her congressman. Her husband calls him a coward. And across the living room, they're yelling at each other. And she says, how can you say what you're saying when you're married to a teacher? And the husband shoots back. You don't get the big picture. So on one hand, he's going, well, the big picture is you're going to lose wages. You're going to lose health care. You're going to lose your benefits. But it's going to be better for me. And I'm not getting it, but it's interesting how this stuff has happened. And, you look at the reality is Rasmussen poll last week said that, 57% disapproved of what Walker is doing. And at the end of this, it's going to come down to, and this is something I've been talking about for some time. At some point, the left is going to have to figure out what the right learned years ago. And that is to use our economic might. We have a whole bunch of money, union pension funds, union health and welfare funds. There's a lot of money there. And as consumers, we spend an awful lot of money. You know, I've often said, you know, the mastery of the right is when Limbaugh says, hey, go buy this whatever, this widget. The minions do. When Glenn Beck says, go buy gold, the minions do. Yeah, we haven't developed that on the left. We haven't developed that allegiance. We haven't developed that consumer mentality that says we're going to support the people who support us. For instance, you know, I do try to buy union-made products. The only bread in my house is the only union-made bread in the area. That's what I buy. If there's probably a better bread I'd probably like better somewhere else, or could be, who knows? But I buy the union-made bread. Why? Because I want to support those folks. When I ship packages, when I want something shipped across the country, I use a union carrier. I use UPS. I think we need to start thinking that way. And this thing with M&I Bank, and with a lot of banks, we've got to think of how are they using that money? Are their executives moving policy to the right? Are they supporting people who we don't support? Because the right figured this stuff out. They've already done it. We've got to start looking that way. We've got to start thinking that way. I don't go to banks. I use credit unions. And I'm very picky of the credit unions I use based on some of the things that they do. So maybe the right is correct. Maybe we are just consumers. And maybe we should be using that consumerism to our benefit. Because I think that, look, there's more of us than there are of them. If we were to say, you know what, we're going to only buy union-made bread or this company's product or this company's product, maybe you stop the Koch brothers. Maybe you stop the Mellon Scapes. Maybe you stop the Coors. I wouldn't buy a Coors beer if I wouldn't drink a Coors beer if my life depended on it. I wouldn't drink Yingling. They're a union-busting company, yet I got union brothers who are my Yingling. These are the kind of things we got to think about and start to become conscious of. The right, as I said, they've done this. They've done their homework. They've got groups out there that say, these are the products that you use. And they fund the Limbaughs and the Becks and all of the right-wing mouthpieces. Why? Because they're people. They get it. They absolutely get it. They get the fact that, look, if you're supporting them, they're going to push the same policies. They're going to continue. That's what it's about, man. And maybe they're right. Let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
USA and resume the ties of mine. Stop taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job and join the people.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call call them at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make history happen!
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Let's go to the phones. Got Gary on line one. How are we doing tonight, Gary?
We're doing pretty good. How about yourself, Rick?
Oh, can't complain. Can't complain.
Sure you can. Go ahead.
I think I've been doing that for the last hour and 32 minutes.
That's all right. That's right. It's sound logic you're professing there, my friend. You know, you'd mentioned the ability of union personnel and union members to become part of a consumer front. And I think it's a great idea with something that should be happening as second nature as part of a union, supporting at least, if not somebody else's union, at least your own. But the fact is, I don't know that that's being done, and that's very unfortunate. We're fortunate here. I'm fortunate here. We've got a great local beer company, a family-owned beer company that's been a Teamster make beer distributed by a Teamster Teamster drivers, and when I go out and I'll go out for dinner, I always buy that beer. And
which one is it?
Utica Club.
Utica Club.
The FXMAT Brewing Company in upstate New York, in
good,
Utica,
good
New York.
For them.
It's been around since 1888. It's a great producer, some fine Saranac products. It's a great brewery. They've treated their employees well over the years. Expanded, went through a difficult period with a terrible fire here a few years ago, and they got back on their feet. They did it with their own members, and they did it with their own employees. And my hat is off to that brewery, and it's done well. And so whenever I go out, whenever my friends go out, we support that brewery just by the simple fact of purchasing that product over someone else's. But to do that, it requires you to do something a little different. It requires you to ask for it. It requires you to maybe in some cases pay an extra dime or half a buck for a bottle of beer that you know is supporting a brother and a sister in that workplace. And the same holds true with it holds true with every aspect of our existence. We need to support that, and we need to do it because it's the right thing to do for ourselves as union members, for ourselves as Americans, to maintain and to make sure those jobs stay. You know, we're in an area where the biggest industry now is retail. And you don't find too many union retail shops around. And that's what's keeping this area afloat. And manufacturing has long gone. But one of the reasons why manufacturing has long gone, because nobody took the effort to instill that pride, that ownership in what you produce, and making sure that you continue to have these folks have a job and continue to produce that product.
You know, I put the blame on that on the corporations, and here's why. For so long, they've been looking out where they can move their production, where they can get cheaper labor, instead of being a partner with their employees and promoting that. Because I remember as a kid, I remember the TV commercial that the ILGA put out, you know, the Look for the Union Label campaign.
Yep.
I found out that a good portion of that was funded by corporate, by the companies as well. It was a partnership, as I was told, between the union and the company, where they were trying to get to save the companies that wanted to stay. They were pushing out this ad for people to start, you know, hey, look for the union label when you're buying something, because you know that that job paid a reasonable wage, it was good for the community, and it was a good product.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see that anymore. And I know some union leaders who are going back to it, which is the reason I asked you what the name of the beer is, because I want to promote those people. If you're doing the right thing, I want to tell your story at the highest mount. I want people to hear it, and I want people to reward you for it. Did we lose Gary?
Yeah, I lost the last few seconds of you there, Rick.
I want to reward those companies for doing the right things.
Yeah,
pure and simple.
It's.
Yeah, we lost him. I appreciate the call, Gary. Thanks so much, brother. Let's go to line two. We got Mike on line two. How are we doing tonight, Mike?
Hi, Rick.
How are we doing?
You watching what's going on in Japan?
I've been watching. Yes.
Yeah. It ain't pretty.
I think one of the things that folks are looking at are, you know, maybe. With a kind of a jaundiced eye, and I know you're going to get into it, the whole nuclear power plant there.
Well, right now, most recent news, and news is really sketchy and in a lot of ways confusing, but it appears right now that they have declared a nuclear emergency at 5 reactors on two sites, and that they are already having radiation releases at least one of those sites, conflicting information about what the levels are. But one thing it seems clear is, as of yet, they have been unable to restore a reliable source of power to the plant. And without that power, they're not going to be able to establish adequate core cooling.
And what happens there?
Well, it's a series of events. The first thing you'll hear a lot about, they're talking about now, venting pressure. Well, the way right now, the only way to cool the reactor is to have the water inside that's boiled to steam is to vent the steam. And when you vent the steam, the water level drops in the reactor, but it carries away heat. So you have to make up that inventory, because if you don't make up the inventory, the water, eventually you uncover the core. And within a few hours of uncovering the core, depending on exactly how much steam cooling you get, you will start a reaction that will lead to melting and destroy the core.
And happens then? What does that look like, or don't we know?
Well, we know from TMI when we saw that, and in that case, what happened was the core collapsed in the middle. It just turned into fragments of fuel pellet and core components. There was melting of the control rods, but in that scenario, they recovered cooling water and was able to send the water in to cool the mass. If they don't get pumps running at some point, and the core should melt, it will damage the vessel and finally penetrate the vessel itself. The problem with a nuclear power plant is that when you shut them down, and all these power plants are shut down, they shut down immediately, automatically, because the seismic sensors sense the earthquake in order to shut down, and they shut down. When you shut them down, though, because they're nuclear plants and you have lots of radioactive material in them from splitting atoms, the radiation emitting from all that stuff keeps making heat. That right after a shutdown, it's about 5% of the rated thermal power. So let's say if you have a reactor core that's rated at 3,000 megawatt thermal, shut down, immediately after shutdown, it will be producing 150 megawatts of peak day heat. That's still a huge amount of energy, and it has to be cooled. And they can't get power to get their pumps running to do that. We're going to lose it.
So let me ask you, if by losing it, what you're saying, is it, you know, we've heard of the China syndrome. Could there be an American syndrome?
Well, I don't think that's likely. I think China syndrome is a misnomer, but what is more likely to happen is you're likely to have a terribly damaged core still contained within the containment structure. And then the amount and the rate of release to the surrounding area and the environment is going to hinge on how long the integrity of that containment holds. And in the case of Three Mile Island, that containment held and never failed. And so eventually, because there was radioactive gas inside the containment bottled up, they had to vent that gas in order to get in to the plant and work on it. So, but that was a controlled venting over time, and likely the same scenario would follow here if it happened. I just hope they get some breakers running or they get some power, because they're in real dire circumstances right now.
Could this be worse than Chernobyl?
Well, Chernobyl has some very special characteristics, there that made it, really onerous. Basically, you had a reactor that didn't have a containment per se. And then you had a steam explosion that actually ejected large amounts of the core and released huge amounts of radioactive gas and particulates into the atmosphere. Not likely to happen at these plants, but you can't rule out something strange happening. I mean, this circumstance should never have happened. The only thing I can say is that the earthquake that occurred, is a lot bigger than anybody had ever seen. And in fact, these plants were designed to survive an earthquake of this magnitude. And in fact, they did. What it appears didn't survive was some of the backup, power system. And also it appears that the grid that would normally provide electric power to these plants must have been damaged extremely as well.
Yeah. Wow, scary stuff. Scary stuff. And I guess, you know, I know you're a proponent of nuclear fuel, and I know several people who are, but these are the kind of things that scare people.
Well, I don't know. I said the proponent. I would say that right now, with as much power tied up in nuclear power plants that we have, we don't really have a lot of other options, because we don't have any way to replace the power on the grid in any quick way with the plants in place.
Yeah. Amazing stuff.
This is absolutely unprecedented disaster of this magnitude.
Yeah, well, keep an eye on this and let us know how things are going. Because you're, I know people aren't sure, but you're the expert on this stuff. You're one of probably the smartest guys on this field that I know. So I take what you have to say very seriously. And if this is what you're saying it is, we should be concerned.
Yeah, you should be concerned. In fact, I'm talking to friends of mine all over the world, you know, this evening about what are they hearing, what are they seeing. And pretty much everybody's in agreement that this is about as bad as it gets at a nuclear power plant. This is those guys at that power plant are making heroic efforts to save those plants.
So, last question, because I got to take a break here. Worst case scenario, how many lives could be lost because of this?
Well, that's difficult to say because, you know, we don't know what the release would look like. If there's no release, if there's no plume, it probably not many, if any. Okay. If we get an energetic release, if we get a worst case, destruction of the cores, then that can depend on, again, what the release looks like, how far it goes, and what kind of countermeasures are able to be put in place.
All righty. Wow. We're going to keep an eye on it. I appreciate the update. I appreciate the information, Mike. Thanks so much. All right, well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your call is 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. Right back after this.
Never been on welfare, and that's one place I won't. be, I'll be working. As long as my two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Amy Morton, Executive Director of CAIU, on the decision to switch to Capital Blue Cross Health Insurance.
By moving to Capital Blue Cross, we were able to achieve savings that we had never expected. We're getting quality care and tremendous customer service. As both a consumer of health care and as the director of this agency, I couldn't be happier that we switched to Capital Blue Cross.
To learn more, call 1-800-976-2242 or visit capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
A sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function, then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made product, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Where common sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
Well, here's some more good news for you. Cumulus Media, according to the Wall Street Journal. Cumulus, the second largest owner of radio stations in the country, has agreed to acquire number three, Citadel. Citadel is the number three radio broadcaster in the country for $2.5 billion in cash and stock. They've had months of talks. The deal was widely expected after Cumulus confirmed last month that it was in exclusive negotiations with Citadel. So good. You know, now you've got the, you know, one, two and three coming together. They're going to take on number one, which is Clear Channel. Clear Channel owns right now about 800 stations across the country. So, you know what I find interesting? More media consolidation. And it's going to go through. I mean, they say, well, it's, you know, pending regulatory oversight. Yeah, there's some of that left. The more and more I look at this, the more and more the game is rigged, which is why I don't hear as much as we should about what's going on in Wisconsin and in Ohio and Idaho and Iowa and Michigan and all of these states where all these right-wing governors are going after their workers. Now, how many people knew in New Hampshire that they're seriously pushing a right-to-work bill that refers only to the public sector? It's going to prohibit collective bargaining for all public sector workers. How many people have heard that? Not many. You know, how many people know that in Tennessee you've got a Republican-backed Senate bill that would end the right of teachers to negotiate for their working conditions? End it. Done. Goodbye. Gone. Kansas, another state, wanting to outlaw employee payroll deductions, so they're not going to take union dues out. When are we going to wake up? When are we going to fight back? I'm glad to see the people of Wisconsin are out in the streets, but it's going to take all of us going to our capitals. Here in Harrisburg and across the country on April 4th, the AFL-CIO is calling for a day of action. Here, you know, we're planning some event for the 4th along with a couple other groups. There's an opportunity to get out in the street. On I think it's May 3rd, the Clear Coalition here in the area is going to have their big rally about the budget. Another opportunity for folks to get out and have their voices heard. I don't know much more, what more it's going to take. If you look at this budget, you look at the assaults that are going on. I don't know how you can be sitting by and doing nothing. A new Rasmussen report today came out, shows that 63% of likely U.S. voters think gaining control of the U.S. border is more important than legalizing the status of undocumented workers who are already here. Only 27% of those polled put legalization as the first part. 10% are not sure, but 63% said, you know, we got to gain control of the border. Most conservatives, 79%, moderates, 59%, think border control should come first. Most liberals, 52%, say a priority should be legalizing the immigrants who are here already. Now, I got a couple of thoughts on this. First thought, I do think you have to control your borders. You got to know who's coming and going. Not to be mean, not to be, not to be nasty, but you got to know who's coming and going across your borders. You got to know what's coming into your country. And we're not doing that. The folks who are here, they were brought here. They were drawn here by a corporate president who wanted to exploit them. We need to help those folks, and we need to hold those accountable who brought them here. Simple. My big problem is that now we're talking about opening up the southern border to Mexican trucks. We don't have control of the border. I don't know that we ever will, but we're going to be paying an awful lot of money to bring Mexican trucks here into the U.S. We're going to be paying for the electronic onboard recording machines that all those trucks are going to have. We're going to be paying for people to monitor those EOBR machines. We're going to be paying for the drug testing. We're going to be paying for a whole bunch of this stuff. And who benefits? And in any scenario, you know, the reality is I look at things and I say, you know, who are the winners? Who's the loser? And time and time again, you and me, we are the losers. We're the ones who end up losing in this equation. The corporations, they're going to benefit from having that border open to Mexican trucks because they're going to pay lower wages. They're going to benefit because they're not going to have to deal with workers. And they're going to pay much, much lower wages. And you and I are going to pay higher everything else. And I look at that and I say, you know, isn't that a massive shift, a massive redistribution of wealth from you and me to the corporate interest? I mean, I would love my conservative friends to, you know, to chime in and say, why, this is a good idea. And in every scenario across the board, when you look at these kind of programs, we lose. We're going to lose jobs. At a time when the country desperately needs employment, we're going to lose tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of jobs. The prices aren't going to come down any. You remember back when trucking deregulation happened? They said, oh, you know, the consumer's going to benefit. We're going to, all the money that those workers are making, because we're going to break down the costs. It's going to cost less to get things transferred around, and those costs will go back to the consumer in lower prices. Well, it didn't happen, did it? Where those savings went were to brokers. Because now you got the people who are selling the loads. Went back to the shippers, not to the companies, because the companies lost. Companies had a rate. They set the rate. They said, for this 1,000-pound skid, you'll be able to ship that for $100 at the time. Now you opened it up. Companies don't have that guaranteed rate anymore. Now you got these gypsies who are, I'll do it for 50, I'll do it for 25. And now we're gonna import labor who's gonna undercut that even further. And at every step of the way, we lose. And why does the trucking industry matter to anybody who isn't in it? Why do you care? Because exactly what they're doing to public sector workers all across this country is what they've been doing to private sector workers for generations. And I use the trucking industry because that's where I was. Spent 21 years in the trucking industry. And I saw an industry that was at one point 85% unionized, meaning that the workers made a good living, had decent benefits, health care, pensions, vacations, sick days, job security. I've watched an industry over my 21 years go from that kind of job security, that kind of middle-class existence, down to a job with no security, a job where you have no voice, the pay is menial, the benefits are expensive, and the retirement is almost non-existent. That is what they want for the public sector workers. That's what they want to turn teachers into. And people like Mike, who works for the nuclear, for overseeing some of the nuclear stuff here in the state. That's what they want. They want to destroy and tear down working conditions. That's what this is about. So during that whole election when they said, we want to run government like businesses, the government should run like a business. That's what they meant, man. We're going to take from the people who are making money, who are doing okay, and we're going to throw it back into the system, and we're going to give it to the people who are doing really well. You think I'm kidding? Look at any industry in this country where the workers were making a reasonable living. You know, they're going after the nurses now. I mean, this healthcare thing, this is part of that. So I asked the question. And again, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Is what they're doing in Wisconsin what you signed up for when you voted for Republicans? Is this the way we should be going? Because I don't think it is. And I go back to that. My grandfather, you know, I tell the story, you know, when he married my grandmother, they were living in their car. This is back in the 20s. I mean, back in the 30s. They were living in their car. Through their hard work, the fact that they were able to join a union, have decent wages, decent benefits, they led a solidly middle-class lifestyle. They retired with some security. Now look into the future 20, 30, 50 years. Is that going to be possible? Especially when you see people like Alan Simpson saying, wow, you know, we need to cut back on Social Security. Those greedy geezers. You know, they want that Social Security that we promised them, and they want that health care that we promised them. Greedy geezers. I don't see him giving up his. I don't see him willing to step up to the plate and fill the gap. But those workers, those retirees, let's go after them. This whole pension reform thing is not about you and me. It's about stealing from those workers to give to the very, very wealthy so they continue to give to them. And I know, it sounds like, well, Rick, you've got a problem with rich people. No, I want everybody to be rich. Problem is, I don't want anyone to be poor. I want people to have opportunity. And I want work to be compensated. So at the end of all of this, it comes down to some very simple ideas. Workers should have a voice on the job, and it shouldn't be stolen from them with some parlor trick in the middle of the night, like thieves. And we should protect and lift people up, not degrade and tear down. And that's what we're doing, folks. That's what we're doing. And when they said, and I said it before, when they want government to run like business, welcome to the business world. We're right back after this.
Freeway ride. They slashed our funding. They cut all our hours by Washington decree. So here I stand with a long line of cars, everyone yelling at me. When did I become a problem? How did the poll become online? The president says, I'm tightening the belt. The only one that's tightening is mine.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Open our doors! Open our doors!
In a locked-down capital so devoid of freedom and democracy that the people, reporters, and even some lawmakers were barred from entering, Republicans in Wisconsin destroyed public worker collective bargaining rights that workers here have had for 50 years. It was an ugly and brutish spectacle of what Democratic lawmakers here called political thuggery and junta rules. The state patrol, commanded by the father of the Republican brothers who lead Wisconsin's legislature, dragged protesters from the assembly entrance as Republicans pushed through the gutting of public worker collective bargaining on a 53-42 vote. Protesters gathered outside the Capitol in Madison were angry as they demanded to be let in Thursday. Tim Berkeley is vice president of AFSCME Local 60 in Madison.
We were up here at about 8 o'clock. What was really difficult was to watch the chief of police of Madison, Noble Ray, be denied entry four times until finally he got through to someone to allow him in. And Jesse Jackson standing at the door being refused entry. It was horrendous.
Trying to walk through the press entrance with permission from Capitol Police to cover the story, I was strong-armed, shoved, and grabbed by the Wisconsin State Patrol.
What are you doing? What are you putting your hands on me for? Wait a minute. What is this? I'm a member of the press corps.
Which side are you on, boys?
Democrats and unions vowed legal challenges, and workers and their unions will continue their resistance, political and otherwise.
The people united will never be defeated.
Democratic senators are returning from exile in Illinois, and no one here defending collective bargaining is accepting this as final. It's been a long 4 weeks for labor leaders in Wisconsin, but after everything that went down during the past 2 days, workers showed Thursday that they still have the resolve to keep fighting. Jesse Russell reports.
However, the question that seemed to be on the minds of the thousands of public sector workers and supporters that gathered outside the Capitol building on Thursday evening was, what now? Wisconsin Education Association President Mary Bell was one of a number of speakers that tried to provide some guidance. Bell went on to say that Momentum had to continue to recall Walker in a year because he has abused the trust of working families throughout the state.
This governor has lied to you. He has lied to me. He has lied to every child, every parent, and every resident in this state. He can never regain that trust.
No.
Why should we trust him again?
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alerts.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Senator Randy Hopper, he's out of Wisconsin. He won his election by 184 votes. What's interesting here, and it's from the bloggingblue.com site. It's under the heading, Randy Hopper, Family Man? He writes, recall target Randy Hopper, a Republican of Fond du Lac, talks a good game about family values. But protesters outside the Hopper house this week in Fond du Lac were met by his wife. Now, understand, you know, this has been a popular tactic. You go to the people's house, you hold your signs, you let them know that you know where they are. The wife came out, probably not too pleased, and told them that their family values senator, Randy Hopper, doesn't live there anymore. Sorry. Mr. Hopper no longer resides here. He's living with his 25-year-old mistress in Madison. Yeah. No confirmation, he writes, on whether the divorcing wife signed the petition to recall Hopper, who represents the Wisconsin's 18th senatorial district. Hopper has been a close ally of Scott Walker, he says, whose billionaire-funded attacks on Wisconsin families is drawing attention internationally and widespread condemnation. So that's pretty interesting. You look at this guy who family values. Are we surprised? No. We look at the guy who wants to run for president. He's, you know, he's had his little dalliances, I guess. And I wonder if the conservatives will forgive. Maybe they will. They didn't forgive. They didn't forgive Pastor Ted. But that was a different. That was a much different scenario. Remember the judge from Atlanta who hooked up with the exotic dancer or hooker, stripper, whatever you want to call her. And they were buying illegal drugs, and he was carrying a gun, saying, you know, don't worry, baby, I'll watch your back anytime. Or maybe it was I'll watch your backside anytime. I don't know. One of them. Anyway, Jack Camp, 67, was appointed to the bench by Ronald Reagan. He pled guilty in November to charges of aiding a felon's possession of cocaine, marijuana, and prescription painkillers. He also admitted to illegally possessing drugs and unlawfully giving his court-issued laptop to the stripper for her use. Anyway, he pled guilty. And now think about this for a second. He, according to the original story, he tried to help her, you know, navigate some tricky waters. He got busted with drugs. He got busted with doing all of this stuff. Now, this is the judge. This is a judge. What kind of time do you think he got? What kind of sentence do you think he got? 30 days. 30 days. And I go, you know what? I don't know that that's enough. I'm sorry. I'm just not feeling it. Not feeling that that was enough. The judge who sentenced him, a guy named Thomas Hogan, said that Camp's at the sentencing hearing that Camp had degraded the federal judiciary. He has encouraged disrespect for the rule of law, and he sentenced him to 30 days. And, you know, I look at this, and I go, if it were you or me, I think we'd be in big trouble. I think we've been in real big trouble. But again, I wonder where this is going to lead him in his life, and I hope the best for him. Another interesting Republican, since we're talking about that, 91-year-old state representative in Connecticut. This is beautiful. This is one of those David Koch, Scott Walker moments where we've always known. We've always known what their true beliefs are. They've just never felt bold enough to say them. And I've been saying that pretty much about all the attacks that have been going on. They've been whispering this stuff to each other in their secret cloakrooms, in their think tanks, and in their little, you know, secret societies for generations. It's just now that they feel emboldened to be able to come out and say them. So you look at this 91-year-old state rep from Barrington, Connecticut. His name's Martin Hardy. He told one of his constituents, who happens to be a manager of the community mental health program there in Connecticut, he said, quote, that the world is too populated and there are too many defective people. Too many defective people. This was a direct quote. You know, the mentally ill, the retarded people, people with physical disabilities, the drug addicts, the defective people. Society would be better off without. You look at Corbett's budget, and you look at budgets across the country, and you look at how much money we're stealing, how much money we're stealing from resources to help people. When the newspaper, the Connecticut Monitor, tried to confirm what Hardy had to say. He said, yeah, he made the comments. He told the Monitor that the world population has increased dramatically, and it's a very dangerous situation if it doubles again. Asked about people who are mentally ill, he asked, apparently referring to the lack of financial resources, can we afford to bring them through? Hardy said, nature has a way of getting rid of stupid people, and now we're saving everyone who gets born. There's so much there. You listen to the Rick Santorums of the world who wants every child to be born and wants health care for every child to be born, but doesn't want health care for teenagers, doesn't want health care for adults, It's kind of a weird tightrope they walk, don't you think? Hardy's conversation with Orman became public at a hearing on the state budget yesterday when a registered nurse and board member of the Disability Rights Center read his account to the House Finance Committee. Afterwards, the woman said she wanted people to know about the representative, whom she did not identify publicly, but he didn't deserve the representative, the people there in New Hampshire. I thought he was a Connecticut. You think about this stuff, and I find it interesting that the positions that they take, and this is what they get away with. And I happen to find this on an obscure blog. The mainstream media didn't bother to report too much of it. I don't know if you saw this. The Wall Street Journal did have a mainstream media source, a story about China, because today the World Trade Organization handed an important victory to the Chinese. They have ruled that the U.S. illegally imposed both anti-dumping and anti-subsidy duties on some Chinese exports in 2007. It goes back to some of the trade cases that Bush said, you know what, maybe need help some of our industries. Bush said this, and the World Trade Organization has shot them down. The trade body's decision set up on limiting the ability of China's trading partners to impose punitive duties on its exports. China, the world's biggest exporter, second biggest economy, faces its biggest wave of trade disputes at the WTO since it joined the Geneva-based organization in 2001. You look at the amount of trade that we're losing, and it's because of these insane policies that I think so many people are struggling, and we're not creating the jobs that we should be because we're allowing too many companies to rush over to China. Understand, China had a $1.6 trillion export business in 2010, a trade surplus of $184 billion. That, if you go back and you look at part of our deficits and part of our spending problems, one of the things that I've said, if we could solve our trade deficit problems, we wouldn't have the problems we have today. The problem is we keep shipping our jobs overseas, and I like what my friend the professor out at the University of Minnesota said. You know, we're trading good jobs for cheap toasters, and the toasters aren't even that cheap anymore. And again, I go back to the trucking scenario where they told us, oh, we're going to have all these savings, and we the consumers are going to be so much better off, and it never materialized. For a short period of time, yeah, the products from China were cheap. But I don't know if you've been paying attention to prices on stuff coming from there. They're not cheap anymore. And the fact of the matter is we don't have the jobs to support the mass consumerism that we've become accustomed to. But we don't have the vision to say, you know what, we need to build things again. Anyway, this case hinged on the legal justification that the U.S. couldn't impose two different classes of duties, both anti-dumping and anti-subsidy, which are completely different in the eyes of the world court, which we are now, I guess, beholden to. And, you know, for my right-wing friends, this is where you lose your sovereignty, because we can't protect our industry. We can't protect an American company anymore. We are getting our hats handed to us by the Chinese. Why? Because they do subsidize their corporations. They do pay for education. They do create an infrastructure for people to make their products. And you know what? They do allow their people to be exploited. And they don't pay very well. I mean, you're never going to be able to compete with that. Which is why we're getting our hats handed to us. And you wonder why we've got unemployment problems the way we do. Anyway, China welcomed the ruling. The panel, a government statement said, has conclusively established that the United States acts unlawfully in the methods by which it calculates and imposes countervailing duties on imports from China. This is a massive victory for the Chinese and a major setback for American corporations, or I should say American corporations who want to stay and do the right thing. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Occasionally, we Texans have a responsibility to explain our Texanity to befuddled out-of-staters. For example, you might have heard about Governor Rick Perry, known for his chronic temper tantrums over big bad government's coercive intrusiveness into people's private affairs. So, how can we explain the fact that his top legislative priority this year is not to cope with the $27 billion budget deficit he's run up, but to require that all Texas women facing the gut-wrenching decision of whether to have an abortion must first undergo a state-mandated sonogram? Yes, Mr. Small Government wants to compel Texas doctors to show an ultrasound image of the fetus to these women, then force them to listen to the fetal heartbeat and sit still for a lecture on fetal development. As a female state senator dryly noted, Perry is going to shrink government until it fits into a woman's uterus. Gubernatorial hypocrisy? Not at all, insists Perry, who points out that women can avoid his version of big government intrusion simply by choosing not to get pregnant. And you'll be glad to know that he's been super helpful in preventing unwanted pregnancies by making Texas the nation's number one provider of abstinence-only sex education. Unfortunately, this abstinence-only doctrine has resulted in Texas also having the nation's third highest teen pregnancy rate. But Perry is undeterred by inconvenient facts. Abstinence works, he recently told an interviewer. But, he was asked, what about all those teen pregnancies? It works, he reiterated. How does he know? From my own personal life, he explained. This is Jim Hightower saying, sure enough, his wife has not been noticeably pregnant in more than a couple of decades, so maybe he has been abstaining from sex. That could explain his chronic insanity, or, as we call it down here, Texanity.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.com.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Welcome back. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. House Financial Services Committee Ranking Member Barney Frank said today that he would reintroduce legislative language next week that would require large financial institutions to pay for federal mortgage assistance programs, according to the Wall Street Journal. Frank said the bill would allow four federal mortgage programs that Republicans are working to eliminate this month to continue operating without threatening to increase the U.S. budget deficit or the debt. He also said his bill would be similar to language he tried to unsuccessfully include in the financial reform legislation last year, saying, quote, I don't mean to demonize, but I think Goldman Sachs and Wells Fargo and Bank of America and Citicorp and Morgan Stanley and the large hedge funds, I think they can pay for this. He was speaking in defense of a $1 billion program approved last year that helps unemployed people make their mortgage payments for up to 12 months. Also, Frank also said that they can afford this $1 billion. Their bonuses alone would pay for these programs. And I guess the question then becomes, and I've heard this from people time and time again, you're rewarding people for not being able to pay their bills. And this is the right-wing frame. That they're, you know, these deadbeats who don't pay their bills, and you're gonna do it for them. And I guess I just don't see it that way. I see that, you know, any one of us could fall on hard times, and any one of us could need a helping hand, Now, look, there's just some situations where, you know what? Unfortunately, it's just never going to happen. There are some folks who have gotten themselves in situations. You just can't. There's just no help there. You've got to make the decision to cut it off, move forward, and move along. But there are a good number of people who need that helping hand. And as I said earlier, had we done what I thought we should have done back when all this mess started, and it's not my idea. I'm not the brightest bulb in the box. I basically stole it from FDR's Home Ownership Loan Corporation, the idea that the government would hold these mortgages. And the rate would be, you know, less than they could get on the open market. The houses would be reassessed. The value would come down. The banks would take a haircut on the payoff. And everything would be moving in the right direction from that point forward. Now, if you couldn't, if you could not hold up your end of the bargain after this readjustment, then they took the house. And then you go forward. But you could have saved an awful lot of foreclosure, and you could have saved an awful lot of money and resource and time and energy simply by doing this right up front, instead of all of the legal wrangling and all of the stuff and the wasted money and the programs that haven't been implemented fully because you've got a recalcitrant party, that the party of no, who won't allow any of this to go forward. And here we are, you know, years after the fact, still talking about it. Also in the Wall Street Journal today, they write, banks are ratcheting up their rhetoric as they fight a mortgage servicing settlement proposal, predicting lasting damage to the U.S. economy in an effort to force regulators to soften terms and any penalties. Yesterday, Wells Fargo's chief executive, John Stumpf, said extensive loan principal reduction would increase the U.S. deficit if taxpayers are forced to pay for the write-downs of loans held by government-controlled Fannie and Freddie. And this is what I'm talking about. You're going to have to, the banks were going to have to take this haircut, and the banks don't want to do that. And what they're threatening is they're saying, well, you know, if we have to do it, we're going to write it off, and the taxpayers are going to get, and we're going to make people miserable. Bank of America's executive issued a similar statement on Tuesday, calling principal reductions no panacea, and questioning the fairness. And going back to what I said, Brian Moynihan, their chief executive officer, said, when you start helping certain people and you don't help other people, it's going to be very hard to explain the differences. I'll explain to you the difference. At some point, we all may need a helping hand. And at other times, we don't. As a nation, we should be coming together, not splitting apart. And what Mr. Moynihan here is doing is trying to drive that wedge between the two neighbors on the street where one guy lost his job through no fault of his own, or his employer said, you know what, we're going to cut your pay by 15%, or you know what, he was a school teacher, and you got a guy like Scott Walker saying, you know what, 10% pay cut, you're going to have to pay more for your health care, and we're cutting your pension, and he can't make the payments anymore. I do think that we need to help those we can. And like I said, those who are in situations that are unhelpable, you move along and you help them do something else. But this idea that, sorry, you couldn't, you lose, we win, not good for us. And, you know, look, I paid my house off. I could easily turn to my neighbor who's struggling and go, hey, I paid mine off. You should have paid yours off. Tough luck. Get out. By doing that, and if you have enough of those, because in my neighborhood, there's only like three or four houses for sale right now. But I've looked at some neighborhoods that during the real downturn, they had 10, 20 houses within. In fact, the one street we just drove down had like 15 houses for sale that were empty. And these are nice $200,000, $300,000 houses, empty. The property values plummet. So if you have to have that moment of radical self-interest, the radical self-interest is if the neighbors on both sides of you lose their home and they're both empty, what do you think your house is worth? It's going to be worth an awful lot less. Anyway, today, for the second day in a row, the House Republicans voted to eliminate another federal mortgage program. Now, the vote was 242 to 177. The House approved legislation rescinding the $1 billion that Barney Frank wanted to use and wanted to have the big banks pay for. So again, you know, another loss for working people, and maybe good for us. You know, maybe we need this. Maybe we need a good smack in the mouth. Anyway, talks between the NFL and the players' union have collapsed today. The players evidently will be filing paperwork in federal court to decertify their union. And I guess the theory here is it's no longer just one entity that the NFL would have to deal with, but each individual player with each individual contract. Now the owners are saying, look, you know, we came to the table and we were willing to give up things, and the players, there were just things they weren't willing to give up on. So, it is what it is. And, you know, I looked at some of the proposals that the NFL has thrown out there. You know, the redistribution of the wealth that's being created by the players. The fact that they want to add another two games without any more income. The fact that they've been talking about rolling back salaries for about a year now. Kind of makes you go, well, what did you give up on? Because they're still not talking about leaving salaries where they were. They're still talking about pay cuts. They're still talking about extra two games. They're still talking about all these things. I'm not sure where anybody gave on this. And this is going to be one of those things where they're going to come to an agreement, and one way or another, and we'll see what happens. Personally, I'm to the point to where another labor issue, but not really. I mean, these guys, I'm not worried about the Donovan McNabbs. I'm not worried about the superstars. You know who I'm concerned about? The guy whose name you never hear. The guy on the special teams who makes a tackle at once a game, who's out there busting his behind in his career, he maybe lasts 3 or 4 years. Those are the guys that I'm worried about. And those are the guys that I think the union is worried about, which is why they wouldn't allow the wage rollbacks, and which is why they're saying, you know what, we don't really need to go to an extra two games. I'm curious, what more do they want? For me, it's about the little guy again. It's not about the Clinton Portises and the Donovan McDabs and the other superstars in the league. It's about the average everyday guy who's probably making about $400,000 a year, which sounds like an awful lot of money. But by the time you end up paying an agent and paying off all of your taxes and your fees, it's not an awful lot, especially when your career is only a couple of years long. And now you're left with lifelong injuries and lifelong disabilities that, you know, in getting into this, I found aren't covered by the league. And in fact, when a player gets hurt, the team has no obligation really to them at all. They're thrown like an injured worker at any job. They're basically thrown to the wolves with the workman's compensation system, which is why NFL owners have been working to change workers' comp laws in different states. I mean, think about that. How amazing that is. Simple, you know, but it's amazing how they've been able to. And look, you know, for the bigwigs, I don't care, and it's even affected me a little bit. It's amazing how easily they divide us, though, isn't it? Just amazing. I hope they do come up with a season. A lot of people enjoy football. Let's take a quick break. 1-888-520 Rick. Back after this.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos
will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. And now for what's going on in the city of Washington, I've got Jeff Holtzman, Talk Radio News Service. Jeff, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, I appreciate it, Rick.
What's going on today?
Well, you know, the president held a pretty lengthy news conference this afternoon. I mean, the point of the news conference originally was to talk about gas prices and what the administration is doing to combat gas prices. The president made a little news when he talked about the fact that he's attempted to boost oil and natural gas production in this country and seemed to take a shot at the oil companies, saying that, you know, they have hundreds of thousands of acres that they have leases on, and yet they're not doing any drilling on that. So he seemed to put the ball in their court and say, listen, if you guys, you know, if you want more oil, it's up to you. You have the keys.
Yeah, well, wasn't that something during the election that we should have taken that land back and given it to somebody who may have?
Well, I think that, you know, obviously the election was drill, baby, drill. And then on the other side, you know, on the Democratic side, we heard a lot about clean energy. And the administration has, so far spent and invested some money in clean energy, obviously wind, solar, and biofuels, to name a few. And the administration obviously is in favor of increased ethanol production. Of course, the EPA just ruling that, you know, increased ethanol is okay for some cars and trucks. So I think that, you know, for oil companies who obviously do control the leases on a lot of this land, it's really up to them. And they've countered by saying, well, you know, some of this land, you know, we have the lease, but there's no oil there, so we're not drilling. So it's really a back and forth over it. But the bottom line is the price of oil is not slowing down because of this. And, you know, global demand is up. There's obviously unrest in the Middle East and North Africa that's driving the price up. And at some point, the rubber's going to have to meet the road, or else we're going to be looking at $5, you know, gas prices this summer.
Exactly. And we've wasted a couple of years where we could have been pursuing alternatives, bickering back and forth between the Republicans and the Democrats. And, you know, and the thing that's going on in Libya right now, good excuse for the prices to go up as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately when you look at it, it's kind of surprising that, you know, the unrest in Libya would lead to higher prices, given the fact that they contribute, you know, maybe less than 2% of the oil that we get from our foreign sources. So not that much in the grand scheme of things, yet, you know, I think a lot of it has to do, obviously, with what goes on in the markets and what goes on in Wall Street, where you have speculators worrying that increased unrest could shut down, you know, global supply levels. And then a lot of people are looking at what's going on in Saudi Arabia right now, where you had protests break out yesterday that were met with, you know, violent clashes from the Saudi law enforcement authorities. You know, there was a planned day of rage protest that was supposed to happen in Saudi Arabia today that pretty much got squashed, you know, because, you know, the Saudis, I just don't mess around with that kind of stuff, and they put the kibosh on that pretty quickly. But so you have the markets reacting to stuff like that, and they're saying, well, you know, what happens if Saudi Arabia falls into chaos? What happens if, you know, Egypt falls back into chaos? Then what happens to global supply levels? And that really just drives the price up and up. And meanwhile, I agree with you. I don't think really anything substantive has been done the last 2 or 3 years since we had that last huge spike in gas prices. And unfortunately, you know, there's nothing that can really solve this problem overnight. We've just kind of got to hope that OPEC boosts their production. And, you know, Obama said today during his press conference that if the disruption of supply levels is serious enough, he'll consider tapping into the strategic petroleum reserve. But, you know, I think that's kind of a last-ditch effort.
Yeah, I would say it would have to be. But, again, you know, it's been 40 years, and we have done nothing to get off the juice. I mean, we've been at the mercy of those folks in OPEC for 40 years now.
Absolutely. I mean, it's really kind of pathetic. And, you know, I mean, there's two fields here. There's two camps. One camp says, well, you know, we've just got to increase our domestic production. And there's another camp that says, you know, it's time that we, you know, move to a clean energy economy. We get off oil completely, at least foreign oil, which we get about 40% of our, or I'm sorry, 50%, I should say, of our oil from, which is a significant chunk. And I just don't think, you know, at the end of the day, there's so much bickering in Congress, you're not seeing any really substantive legislation to get anything done. I mean, you saw a couple bills die in the Senate toward the end of the lame duck session that would have, you know, placed higher standards, you know, on oil companies, and it would have also invested more money in clean energy sources, and those measures both failed. I don't see anything right now that looks very promising either in the House or Senate.
No, just more bickering. Going back to the press conference, what did the president have to say about the tsunami and what's going on there in Japan right now?
The president said, you know, what you'd expect him to say. He said that they're monitoring the situation closely, and he basically said that, you know, he's instructed Steve Chu, the energy secretary, to work with Japan's, you know, energy ministers to, you know, to see what they need. And he pledged all assistance, you know, that Japan would request, he pledged, would be available. So, you know, it's a situation where, you know, all we can really do is, you know, is keep up with our humanitarian aid, keep up with our foreign aid. I think, obviously, we have capabilities in terms of our military to help the Japanese out, too. And I believe one other thing that's kind of important, obviously, you've heard a lot of reports about the nuclear reactors in Japan you know, how they basically their cooling levels failed. The president did pledge to send coolant, extra coolant, over to Japan to help out, to help, you know, put those fires out with some of the nuclear reactors, because there are obviously a lot of concerns that you could see, you know, possibly another Three Mile Island type scenario develop in Japan.
Yeah, don't say that. That's our area right here. So don't get people all worked up over that.
Oh boy.
In looking at the budget cuts, you know, how do the there's some common ground between what's going on in Japan right now and what the Republicans want to cut.
Yeah, I actually it's interesting because, you know, the big Republican proposal that passed the House that would have cut $61 billion really decreased funding significantly for the NOAA as well as the National Weather Service, both of which are agencies that look out for things like tsunamis and monitor those and send alerts out. And I believe that the cuts to both of those agencies were in the hundreds of millions of dollars, like at least over $100 million. It's interesting because obviously, you know, neither party was able to come to an agreement on a budget this week, so now they're looking at another short-term measure, which would fund the government for another 3 weeks beyond next Friday. And in this short-term CR, there would actually be about $90 million worth of cuts to NOAA, in it. So, either way, and this is a proposal that's expected to pass because lawmakers, you know, they don't want a government shutdown. So they're going to go ahead and pass this CR to give themselves more time to negotiate a budget. And meanwhile, when it passes, it will cut the budgets of these agencies that are tasked with this vital, you know, job of monitoring things like natural disasters, tsunamis, earthquakes, and the like.
Yeah, why would we want to know what's coming?
You know, hey, if it's that bad, sometimes maybe you don't.
There you go. maybe that's the rationale. What other questions went on today in the big press conference?
You know, the president was asked about Libya, and you know, the bottom line is that Muammar Gaddafi has pledged up until this point to stay in power, to fight the insurgency and the rebel forces in his country. And it's interesting because yesterday, President Obama's Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, made an interesting comment while during testimony before the Senate. He said, you know, Gaddafi very likely has enough firepower to keep himself in power and to, you know, overcome the rebel forces that are, you know, looking to oust him. And Obama was asked if he agrees with that. He basically said that, you know, James Clapper was not making a policy statement. It's not the administration's policy that they want to see Gaddafi in power. And I think that that's what a lot of concerns people had a lot of concerns over that statement. They thought it meant that the administration was looking at, you know, the end game being Gaddafi staying in power. Obama asserted today that is not the end game they hope to see. They want Gaddafi out as soon as possible, and it's in the best interest of his people as well as the international community.
Yeah, you know, some people have been telling me, well, what we need to do is drop a bomb on him and kill him like we did to his son years ago, and I'm not so sure that's the answer.
Well, I think that's a very,
we've already got enough problems.
Yeah, well, and we're pretty overextended as it is at this point, you know, with our military. I think that, you know, obviously there have been a lot of calls for imposing a no-fly zone. And that's something that, you know, we've been hearing about for a couple weeks, but it hasn't happened yet. And I think one of the reasons is because, you know, if you listen to Secretary Hillary Clinton testify the other day, it's very, very hard to do. In fact, Clinton and others in the administration don't think that it would really do much to limit and to curb, you know, Gaddafi's influence and, you know, the violence that he's been using against the rebel forces. You know, so there have been many reports that Gaddafi has been using airstrikes against the rebels, specifically in the eastern part of the country where you have the oil infrastructure. So a no-fly zone would make sense. I just think at this point we're days away from something maybe happening on that. I know that, you know, NATO leaders are going to meet Tuesday. Secretary Clinton will be meeting with them. And Secretary Clinton will also next week be meeting with the political group that's been set up by these rebel forces.
So do you think, you know, I keep hearing Gingrich and people like Pawlenty saying, well, we need to step up, do this stuff. I think Gingrich would have us in war. We'd be at war with them right now if Gingrich were in power. It's nuts, just nuts. What else went on in the press conference today?
You know, I mean, obviously the president talked about the budget negotiations, getting back to that, and just a couple quick points on that. He said that it's irresponsible for Congress to keep passing these short-term measures because it creates uncertainty. You know, so obviously he is not happy with the fact that neither party has reached a long-term budget. You know, we talked about his comments on the tsunami and his comments on Libya. He was also asked one question about Bradley Manning, who, of course, is the, you know, the private, the Army private who is a suspect in the WikiLeaks controversy. And, you know, there have been, it was reported earlier this week that, you know, Manning faced, you know, what basically some people were calling torture, in his confinement in Virginia. The president was asked about, you know, whether he had spoken to the Pentagon and what they had to say about that. He didn't give much. He said that he was satisfied with what the Pentagon said to him in terms of how they were handling Bradley Manning. So, you know, we'll probably learn more about that in the coming days, but the president was pretty mum on that today.
Yeah. Anything about Wisconsin?
Nothing about Wisconsin, Rick. I was very surprised. You know, I mean, this is, you know, the first press conference, news conference that the president's held in a couple weeks. And, you know, unfortunately, he only took about six or seven questions. Two of them I thought were throwaway questions. One was a question of, you know, has he spoken with any Middle Eastern leaders? Well, of course he's been speaking with Middle Eastern leaders. I mean, he's probably on the phone with them every day, if not every other day. Another was a question about his personal feelings on the tsunami, given the fact that he'd, you know, been in Asia less than a year ago. So I thought that those were two pretty throwaway questions, and nothing on the, you know, the fact that, you know, Governor Walker signed the anti-union bill into law yesterday, and I thought that was pretty disappointing that he wasn't asked about that.
You know, again, it's just frustrating.
They got to start calling on Talk Radio News Service, I'll tell you that, because if they do, they'll get some good questions.
All righty. I hope that to be the case. Jeff Holtman, Talk Radio News Service, I appreciate your time. Look forward to having you guys back again.
Thanks, Rick. Take care.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people on the talk.
You could always speak your mind. You worked so hard to say what's right. I watch you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show. Where working people come to talk.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call them at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
the proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come on, ya good workers, good news to the U.S.
You know, at the end of it, that's what it comes down to. Which side of this whole battle do you find yourself? I go back to that story in the Wall Street Journal today. The husband and wife who were at each other, the brother and sister who were on opposite ends. And in fact, the one guy in the article, he's a millionaire who owns a plastic injection company. He claims, and you got to love this, that he would change positions with his sister anytime. Take her pay, take her golden, you know, her golden parachute pension funds, and take the Cadillac healthcare plans. He'd give it all up. Guy who's a millionaire. That's how bizarre this whole thing has gotten. I'll bet you if you really did it, I bet you he wouldn't. When he realizes how hard it is to actually be a teacher. When he realizes how difficult that job really is. You know, I got three kids. It's hard enough for me to keep the three of them in line, let alone 30 kids in a classroom. And as we cut education funding, 40, 50, who knows where this goes? Especially here where you're talking about $1 billion in cuts. Amazing stuff. It has been a very interesting week. And, you know, this thing in Wisconsin has taken on a life of its own. I'm glad we had the opportunity to go there. Because it gave us really a perspective that I think most people don't have. These are very, very peaceful people. And, you know, when you see these talking heads like that nitwit Palin say, oh, union thugs, I know that that's not reality. The reality is that these are good, decent, hardworking people who just want to have a voice where they work. They just want to be able to make a living, and they pay taxes too. You know, all of these assaults, and I'm glad the Republicans are doing it because it is bringing people together, and it is tearing down the silos on the left. One of the things I've always said about the right is that they understand empire. You know, they have their own little fiefdoms, but they understand empire. They get groups, one way or another, you know, to be marching in the same direction. The left has never been able to do that. You've got your little group over here, you got your little group over there, you got your little group over here, and they never seem to come together. I'm looking at this as an opportunity because, as one of our guests said this week, you know, I saw teachers standing with Teamsters. I saw policemen standing with iron workers. I saw, you know, these firemen standing with Teamsters and steel workers and all of these and college students standing with union members and all of these people coming together in a community and realizing why they were there. That is amazing. That is an amazing accomplishment that no amount of money that labor could have spent or the progressive groups could have spent accomplished. That kind of thing only happens when someone puts a gun to your head and says, we're stealing from you. That kind of circling the wagons, that kind of coming together, only happens when you're under attack. That's it. You know, this country only seems to come together when there is massive crisis. You know, World War II, the country came together. After 9/11, the country came together. You know, I was rooting for George Bush. Couldn't stand him, didn't want any part of him, but I didn't want him to fail. Never once did you ever hear me say, I want George Bush to fail. No, I said, I want him to go get bin Laden. I want him to do what's in the interest of the country. Sadly, he chose to do something completely different. Start an ideological war in Iraq that we didn't need and has made us less safe and has cost us immensely both in blood and treasure. But I never once said, gee, I hope he fails. Yet we have a party in this country that will do anything that they can possibly do to make the president fail. They will do anything in their power. Break laws, break precedent, anything they can possibly do to make the Democrats fail. And that has never been more apparent than what we saw happen this week in Wisconsin. They didn't need to do that. They really didn't. And again, it shows how arrogant and how stupid they can be. They didn't need to ram that bill through to steal rights away from public sector workers. They didn't need to do it. They could have followed the rules. It didn't matter if the Democrats came back. They were going to win anyway. Why didn't they follow the rules? And this is what gets me about them. They have the majorities to ram through whatever they wanted. They just had to wait an extra day or two. But they chose not to. Why? Because they're in charge. And they want you to know that. In all of these state houses across the country, the Republicans want you to know that they are in charge. And they're running things like a business. And they're going to steal from those workers as business has stolen from their workers over the generations. So as this weekend comes, and tomorrow is supposed to be a huge, huge day in Madison. I guess Willie Nelson's going to bring his bus and his pot and you know, going to have a big tractor fest, as all of the farmers from around the state of Wisconsin are going to bring their tractors, and they're going to have a concert there with Willie. I'm not a big Willie Nelson fan, but I think it'd be neat to see. I've heard reports of 200 to 250,000 people showing up. I think that would be incredible to be a part of. And next week we're going to get people who were there. We're going to follow this story to its conclusion, which could be 6-10 months from now, as all this winds its way through the courts, because what they did this week, I think, is illegal. And what Scott Walker is doing every day by denying people access to their capital is contempt. And I'm hoping at some point a judge wakes up and says, you know what, Scotty boy, the police are coming to get you. And you know what? I think the police would honor that order. I don't think they would stand by idly. I think they'd say, oh, yeah, let me be the first one. So as we move forward in these coming days and weeks, we're going to be following all of these stories, because this is what's important. This information is important, because as next year comes around, and I'm as disappointed as anyone in our president, the fact that nothing came out of his lips today about Wisconsin, and that he has not taken a position, a strong position. He said a couple of things. But he hasn't really come out in favor of the workers. He hasn't really stood up. And especially, I mean, think about this. This is his opposition. These are the people who want to destroy him. And he's doing nothing. I got to wonder why. Anyway, just amazing stuff. Another Republican plan. You know, they're trying to defund NPR, which, again, you know, they've been wanting to do for years. But they also said today that, you know, they're going after Planned Parenthood. And Planned Parenthood said today that they're going to sue South Dakota if their governor, Dennis DeGarde, signs an anti-abortion bill that would require a 72-hour waiting period before going through with an abortion. Sue Stutz, CEO and president of Planned Parenthood in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, called the bill egregious and a violation of the Constitution. Along with this waiting period, they've also passed a measure earlier in the month that would make people undergo counseling. So you would have to go to some pregnancy help center. So basically they can browbeat you, and you can be harassed by some zealot. You know, we had these two nitwits on the corner. They were debating about when the end of the world was coming. No, it's going to be May 21st. No, it's going to be the 23rd. No, they're going back and forth. And I, you know, as I looked at them, I go, you know, I wonder what their mothers would think if they saw them standing here on the corner, and if they're rethinking that whole abortion idea. Or maybe I wanted to go up and say, well, how if a car jumps the curb and takes you both out and it's the end of the world for both of you? But I didn't, because I try to be nice.
Anyway, the South Dakota bill is another one of the radical right-wing assaults on women's choice. And, you know, you're thinking about the people in South Dakota. And I go back to this clip of the one South Dakota legislator who, I mean, just really the most perverted.
A real-life description to me would be a rape victim. Brutally raped, savaged. The girl was a virgin. She was religious. She planned on saving her virginity until she was married. She was brutalized and raped, sodomized, as bad as you can possibly make it, and is impregnated. I mean, that girl could be so messed up physically and psychologically that carrying that child could very well threaten her life.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you listen to the amount of thought that went into that. Brutalized and beaten and raped and sodomized. Scary. I mean, honestly, I mean, I these people scare me, the amount of thought they put into these exceptions that they come up with. And you know what's weird? About a month ago, we went to the Planned Parenthood people and said, you know, we'd like you to come on the program and talk about a particular issue. Because they're, you know, been talk here in the state of defunding them as well. And they're like, no, we're going to wait until the attack comes. And I'm like, why not get out in front of that? Why not throw the first punch every once in a while instead of absorbing all of these hits? Why not get out there and tell the story that Planned Parenthood is not the place where, not a place that only does abortions, that 98% of what it does is women's health. You know, especially in a state like Pennsylvania where the gynecologists are fleeing, you need places like Planned Parenthood for low-income women to be able to go see a doctor every now and again. Especially, you know, during the gestation period for the people who aren't having abortions. That's what the right never wants you to understand. Planned Parenthood does an awful lot more. But what they focus on the fact that Planned Parenthood actually plans things, thinks that maybe women should have an idea of how to not have children by offering contraception and being able to maybe plan their family, thus the name Planned Parenthood. We never hear that out of the right. All we hear out of the right is bury your head in the sand, don't talk to your children about sex, and most certainly don't teach them how to protect themselves, and only talk about abstinence. Because abstinence only works so well. That's why most of us are here. Abstinence only education. Anyway, I hope everyone has a great weekend. This has been a great week. If you missed any of the programming this week, you can go to thericksmithshow.com, download our podcasts. They're from the last couple of years are there for your entertainment, your enjoyment. So right there, you got any questions, comments, thoughts, ideas, how to make the show better, feel free to email me, Rick at the